responded to a request to send nurses and counselors to Louisiana and Mississippi, and we sent three waves of staff to assist the Gulf Hospice's care for displaced dying patients. The last two staff just returned home last Thursday. I wanted to tell you about that because I'm so proud of our nonprofit agency. It seems that our unofficial motto is, we'll find a way to do it, let's just get to work. And the staff and volunteers are remarkable, and we all feel very privileged to provide end-of-life care in this wonderful county of San Luis Obispo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, supervisors, for your recognition and support of quality hospice care in our community. I'm Donna Kane, and I'm the Director of Hospice of San Luis Obispo County. November marks our 28th anniversary as our community's only volunteer hospice supporting children and adults who are grieving or living with life-threatening illness. 90% of our services are provided by good people and volunteers in our community, which makes our mission and delivery quite unique. I am happy to extend an invitation to all of you supervisors and to our community to our celebration of a Latin American tradition called Dia de los Muertos, Day of the Dead, and our celebration is tomorrow on the 2nd from 11 to 7 o'clock. We have a very dynamic Latino coordinator through her volunteers that has arranged for tomorrow. We have a beautiful altar. And you're all invited to bring a photo of a loved one you'd like to remember, favorite foods or favorite objects, and maybe you have a memory or a story to share. We hope to see you there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
for all that you do. I have one request to speak form on the presentation calendar, Michael Kovacs.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Michael Kovacs from District Number 5, unincorporated areas. I have been hearing and listening to about 15 years here on the agenda items, practically each and every board meeting times.
Michael, is this on the presentation calendar or public comment?
Presentation calendar.
Okay, thank you.
I've been listening to this. What I meant was the resolution, board resolution commending various staff employees for their extended or whatever kind of services for the county government. Well, I just want to comment about it after listening to this for 15 years. I have been one of the 100 million corporate America private employees for over four decades. After the fifth year, we received from personnel department a button, a bronze button in a mail with a letter. After 10 years, we received a silver button, space shuttle. I was working on aerospace. And at the 15 years, I received the gold button of the space shuttle. In the 28 years, I received a gold button with a diamond in it, with a letter. There has been no ceremonial resolutions passed for time lost for the benefit of the shareholders like we have. I wonder, have you ever calculated the total man hours that have been lost by these resolutions commending the staff? Extraordinarily contrary to the vast majority of employment in this nation. And by the way, this extensive recognition, I don't want to take anything away from these good people doing good jobs. No, not at all. But the public is damaged by thousands and thousands of man hours per decade lost because of these agenda items. And by the way, have you ever thought about citing some citizens, commending them with a resolution? I, my neighbors, and every friend of mine considers Mr. Eric Green the citizen of San Luis Obispo County, if not the citizen of State of California. Never a single word has been mentioned by your board or our supervisor relevant to the same district about the tireless effort by Mr. Green has been has been putting into for the benefit of the public. Of course, most of his comments and remarks and questions went in one ear and came out on the other. We do not appreciate that.
Thank you.
I repeat, Mr. Green is a citizen of San Luis Obispo County.
Thank you. I would agree with you. That's one time, Michael, we do agree. Mr. Shajan, and then Mr. Lenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think I've ever figured out how much time we spend here, but the real problem is that I've never been able to figure out why corporate America working on a shuttle system will charge $1,000 for a screwdriver to the government.
Mr. Lenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to respond that I have said publicly and privately commending some of the work that Eric Green has done and will continue to do so, and I think that we disagree on that particular aspect, that he has been noted for being a watchdog, for dotting the I's and crossing the T's, and he has been commended in public for doing that, and I will continue to do so.
Thank you. I have no other request to speak here. So with that, we will move on to the regular public comment, and I have several requests to speak forms. The first is Julie Rodewall, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning, Board. Julie Rodewald, County Clerk Recorder. I'm just here to remind everyone, if they haven't been paying attention, that there's an election 7 days from today. Today is the last day that we can receive applications to mail absentee ballots. However, we will continue to issue absentee ballots in our office up until 8 o'clock on election night. Also, I just want to inform our viewers that we will be open this weekend, as has been our tradition, from 9 to 1, both Saturday and Sunday, for someone that's realized at the last minute that they can't get to the polls or into our office during the week. They can come in this weekend, 9 to 1. Just a reminder, we are in the new government center. Don't show up at our old address. We're at 1055 Monterey Street, and the doors will be open to serve our voters. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Eric Greening, followed by Michael Kovacs.
Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I do appreciate the accolades for Mr. Kovacs. However, it is not accurate that I don't feel appreciated here. I have at various times heard expressions, both collective and individual, and certainly my own supervisor, Mr. Patterson, has been very appreciative, having requested my service on the Citizens Transportation Advisory Committee on behalf of the 5th District, and all of you have expressed appreciation for my service collectively on the Water Resources Advisory Committee on an environmental seat. Another piece of cleanup is our friends from hospice meant to mention that their Dia de los Muertos event was at 1304 Pacific Street in San Luis Obispo. And I do believe, as long as you keep a balance of recognizing citizens and employees, continue the recognition. It is true that sometimes people do all chime in saying the same thing and the clock runs, but when you're appreciating someone, that just sort of goes with the territory. Anyway, the topic I came to speak on, now I'll have to talk fast, now that the early sunsets remind us that the end of the year is approaching, it's time to prepare to make the resource management system findings for the year. Do we yet know the date of that hearing? The findings are made on a community-by-community basis, but not all communities or areas in the unincorporated part of the county are covered. Do we need to look at that? For example, the Edna Valley and Arroyo Grande Fringe are a fast-growing area that at present get no specific scrutiny through this process. Should we schedule a hearing prior to the RMS hearing itself to look at the map of the county, define the boundaries of areas specifically covered by the process, decide if there are uncovered areas that should be covered, and begin the process of extending scrutiny to those areas? With state housing and community development breathing down our necks and the COG decision for unincorporated areas to take on 2,000 extra units beyond what proportionate population would call for, the entire unincorporated portion of the county is at risk of growth surges that would outrun the resource base and ability to provide services. Please be sure that we're not caught with our guard down. Thank you.
And thank you for your comments, Eric. Michael Kovacs, followed by Jesse Arnold.
Michael Kovacs from District 5. Well, I don't want to respond and kick balls back and forth on the issue of county citizenship, county citizen of by Mr. Eric. I would go to war to defend his right to disagree with me. I was in the war for the same cause. I would continue to be so. However, there is only one proof of ability, and that's results. I have been measuring results, reactions by the board to his and other citizens' comments, questions, for over a decade. He did not. I learned it from corporate America. There is no progress without controversy. He does not believe in that. He just continues going on, and therefore his effectiveness is far from the desired level of impact. Specifically, I have no time to bring up and substantiate my statements. One thing. The other thing is I have no time. The taxpayers have limited time, 3 minutes, because the tax receivers disallow more than 3 minutes, no matter how important the subject issue being discussed. So, the other item I was trying to talk about is two weeks ago, your board had rubber-stamped staff recommendation to approve $6 million salary increases, unbudgeted salary increases, 5.7% or so, 65 or 70% higher than the private sector is receiving already in this county. Why are you catering so much to the staff in every way? Is it because you don't believe you can get reelected without a county employees association? Is that so? We had proved 2 years ago we removed the 5th district supervisor despite the support of the county employees association. You can be removed by us if you fight for it correctly, the right way. The formula that you use for the year-to-year adjustment, you don't call them pay raises, benefit salary adjustments. According to Mr. Webster, adjustments can be either up or down. Here, it has never been adjusted down.
And thank you for your comments, Mr. Kovacs. Jesse Arnold, followed by Lori Heiser.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the board. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria, and I'm here to speak on genetic engineering and the need for labeling. As you know by now, the task force of the Health Commission to study genetically engineered crops will not be taking a position on labeling. The Ag Commissioners group previously at the beginning said they wouldn't, although Bob Lilly, the Ag Commissioner, I believe has told you that he personally supports labeling. But since neither one of those groups will be taking a position on labeling, I think it's your turn to step up to the plate where they would not. And there is ample evidence that labeling is needed. I also wanted to comment on what's been in the news. As you know, two new members were added to the task force of the Health Commission, and I think that's a good thing. And I also want to commend the people, the citizens, who have been following that issue and going to those meetings, and I believe it was their work that inspired the commission to unanimously vote to add two new members, a biomedical researcher and a biomedical ethicist. And I think I recall that I asked for an ethicist to be on one or both of those panels previously, so I certainly feel that's a good idea, and I hope that works to the advantage of all the citizens. Finally, I will, when I stop speaking, give you a copy of the Safety Testing and Regulation of Genetically Engineered Foods. This is a paper by William Fries and David Schubert. It was brought to the attention of the Health Commission Task Force by Nancy Reinstein, who is a registered dietitian and has a PhD in nutrition. One of the things this paper points out is that BT corn, which we've talked about here before, they found that all the different varieties of BT corn, there's extra lignin in the corn stalk. And lignin is the main component of wood. In other words, the corn stalk is more like a tree trunk than a corn stalk. We don't have time to debate the pros and cons of extra lignin, but the point is that this is something extra that was added. Now, the myth has been when we genetically engineer something, all we get is the extra trait, in this case BT, and nothing else. Well, this is telling us we are getting something else, extra lignin. And this tells us we could be getting other unidentified extra things in there at no extra charge. But I think if you asked your constituents if they wanted BT corn labeled, remember BT stands for a bacterial toxin, do they want to know if the wonderful fresh sweet corn they're buying locally has a bacterial toxin in it? I think they would tell you they want to know. So I hope you will take this up and call for labeling of genetically engineered foods. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Lori Heiser, followed by David Dugan. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Lori Heiser, and I'm an IHSS worker. And this morning, I'm here to talk to you as a United Domestic Worker Union member and a member of the Medical Plan Negotiating Committee. I'm here to talk to you about two very important things that are going wrong with the negotiations. We need to have you inform us of exactly who our employer of record is going to be as of January 1st. And the breakdown in communication is going wrong right now with the medical plan because you're asking us to take a leap of faith and improve a plan when we don't know who our employer of record is going to be. And this is not clear in the wording of how the negotiations are going forward. And so we can't approve a plan. And so the whole plan's going to go out the door if we don't know who our employer of record's going to be and when exactly that's going to take place. And this plan was supposed to be approved as of November 1st. And I don't think the public authority is keeping you fully aware of what's going on, and everything's falling apart. And these negotiations have been going on for a year. And the other thing is it's been asked to be delayed to February 6th, and that is totally unacceptable for us. We've been delaying for over a year now. We will not agree to any more delays. And because the delays, you've never met any of the dates that you were supposed to meet anyway since the contract's been approved. And so we don't believe that you will meet February 6th delay anyway. So we're really trying here very hard, and we have continued to talk even though you haven't met dates that you were supposed to meet, and we haven't shut down the negotiations, but you're asking too much at this point. And we really need you to please, you know, help us out here, give us what we need by telling us what our employer of record is going to be, and please make the January 1st date. We need this done within the next week. Please, we've had the public authority person went out on personal time and did not make this a priority before they left. And we don't think that 1,100 workers, 1,200 of your county workers should have to pay for this. They have been waiting since January of 2005 for their medical plan to be put into place, and that is not right. And
thank you for your comments, but your time is up. So David Dugan is the final public comment request to speak for.
Bored, very bored. I believe some of you are aware of a tentative agreement has been hammered out concerning the Los Osos CSD and the State Revolving Fund. But I would like to present a hypothetical scenario to you. What if a group of people from within without the community was determined to derail the process and cost the property owners of Los Osos tens of millions of dollars? And let's imagine this group's leaders gathered at the Los Osos CSD office to plan and plot with elements in the Los Osos CSD office. Now, this is hypothetical. And these persons would go as far as to enjoin privileged information, confidential documents, as well as documents not considered public as of yet. And someone, not unlike myself, versed in audio-video recording, was able to place a wireless device, not unlike this pen, within the office, as well as a video device outside the office, to capture these plotters in the act. Now, would you consider these acts to be illegal? Would you consider these acts to be would you consider these acts to be investigational as far as the law is concerned? Now, this is hypothetical. But I believe if staff and others are plotting hypothetically, and there is information on video and audio, that this probably should be presented to the legal authorities. But I think the greater wrong is being done here is that as we stand here, as you sit here, there are those who are trying to derail the process, a process handed down and put together by the state and the Los Osos CSD, which is fair. Actually, it's more than fair. They gave us more than what we wanted. So I would remind people out there, there are eyes and ears and recording devices. And if you expect a reasonable sense of privacy in a public area, forget it. There's no privacy in the foyer of the county clerk's office. If I want to listen what's going on in there, and you are talking out loud, I can hear it, as well as in the Los Osos CSD office. So I would say beware. Hypothetically, this may or may not have happened. I was in the office yesterday, and I saw and I heard. Hypothetically. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
We're not on the consent.
We haven't gotten to the consent agenda yet. This is still public comment, general public comment. I have your request to speak form right here. Sure. Mr. Shajan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric, for your request of Edna area and Royal Grande Wasna area, we do have a scenic viewshed ordinance in place that's and it's been put to practice and has served the purpose. Addresses the skylining, silhouetting, things of that nature.
There are still six other areas where RNS findings are made. Thank
you. You brought up the Edna area and Royal Grande, which happened to be in my territory. I thought I'll respond to your need. Thanks for bringing it up.
Mr. Patterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment on that same issue regarding the RMS study. I don't see anyone from planning here, but I'll bring that question up regarding the areas that are reviewed for RMS to see if there are any holes in the area review. And also, I just wanted to publicly thank County Clerk Judy Rodewald for making the effort to facilitate people voting in all elections, including special elections. Keeping the county clerk's office open Saturday and Sunday certainly facilitates everyone having the opportunity to vote in these elections, and I appreciate that effort.
Thank you. I have no more requests to speak lights up here. So with that, I will close the public comment period and open it up to public comment for the consent agenda. I have a request to speak Jesse Arnold, followed by Michael Kovacs.
Thank you, Chairman Bianchi and members of the board. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. I simply wanted to know what the alternative publication procedures are going to be on that planning department. The last item, I think it was, what's the number on the slip?
B11.
B11, yeah. So if they elucidate on that, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Michael Kovacs.
Thank you, madam. I am wishing to comment on B4, item B4, request by Supervisor Bianchi to allocate $2,326 from her second district community project funds to the Cayucos Senior Citizens Club for the cost of auto insurance for being used to transport senior citizens. I think Supervisor Bianchi should be commended for this allocation, for this amount, and her concern about senior citizens. I wish if not only her, but each and every one of you consider the senior citizens in your respective districts at least to the same extent Mrs. Bianchi has been in her tenure of 6 years.
Seven.
So I encourage your board members, please pay attention to the senior citizens in your allocation of community project funds in general in all districts, but in my district number 5 in particular. Even though Mr. Patterson is not a senior citizen yet, but we in North County would appreciate if he would also consider us to the same extent as Mrs. Bianchi have. Thank you.
And thank you. And as far as I'm concerned, a senior citizen is anyone 10 years older than I am. I have no further request to speak forms on public comment, so I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board. Mr. Ovett, do you have any?
None, Madam Chair.
Mr. Patterson?
No, ma'am.
Mr. Lenthal?
No, Madam Chair.
Mr. Ashajan?
None, thank you.
And I have one, B11, and the administrator wishes to speak.
I think we finally picked up that flashing light.
That's yeah. Well, it doesn't flash. It just is there.
On item B11, I was just going to address that very briefly. The alternative publication issue is the provision that says we don't have to, with the board's permission, we don't have to publish in the newspaper the complete copy of an ordinance, which is the basic starting point, but we're allowed to publish either a summary or if the item is not suitable for summarizing, then a notice that indicates what the ordinance is or the ordinance change and where any interested party can get a full copy of the text of the ordinance, the office where it's available. It's something that we routinely do that California law provides for as a cost-saving measure versus the cost of having to publish in a newspaper of general circulation the entire text of what could be, in some cases, a very extensive ordinance. So that's the alternative publication schedule.
Okay. Thank you very much. And that concludes the public portion of the consent agenda. May we have a move of approval?
Move. Second.
May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Ovett?
Aye.
Mr. Ashajan?
Aye.
Mr. Lenthal?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. That concludes the consent agenda. We will move on to item C1. May we have an introduction of item C1, please?
Item C1 is a hearing to consider an ordinance amending section 2.48.095 of the County Code and increasing the Board of Supervisors' salary by 3.18%. This item was introduced on October 18, 2005. Recommendation is for approval and instruct the chairperson to sign.
May we have a staff report, please?
Madam Chair, members of the board, good morning. Richard Greek, Personnel Director. You introduced this item on October 18th for the public hearing that's taking place today. Staff recommends that you do adopt the ordinance that adjusts the Board of Supervisors' annual salary by 3.18% effective January 1st, 2006. Just a few key points. This is formula-driven, and it was established by the process was established by ordinance back in 1998, the past century. The average percent change in salary of the comparable counties that were reviewed was 3.18%. Their range as of July 1st was 0 to 13.57%. What this results in relative to the monthly salary is approximately a move of from $5,724 per month to $5,905 per month for each board member. If the increase is approved by your board, your salary will still be approximately $903 per month below the average of the counties that we're comparing to. That's approximately 13.3%. So staff's prepared to answer any questions you may have as you hold your hearing.
Are there any questions of Mr. Greek? I see no lights.
Okay.
So with that, I have to put a marker in all these things I have to sign, and I will open it to the public. I have two requests to speak forms. The first is Eric Greeny, and the second is Jesse Arnold.
I'm Eric Greening, and while I don't encourage you to raise your salaries, neither do I object. The argument against is that it looks unseemly for you to do so when many county services are still struggling for adequate funding, and while in-home supportive services workers toil unceasingly for poverty-level income. The argument for is that most other county employees are not expected to forego increases year after year. You have been gallantly doing so because, alas, you were forced to make the decision on your own behalf, which makes it political. The issue of parity in relation to other county employees does need examination. Last year, I asked how many county employees have higher salaries than yourselves. The budget document gives a rough idea, but since salaries are given in ranges rather than as precise figures, it's hard to come up with a number. It is clear, however, that the number of county employees who receive more than your current or even proposed figure is in the hundreds, including not just department heads, but middle management and even some non-management. Each of you on the board has a more than full-time job, so you shouldn't feel guilty should you choose to take this increase, but you should feel a heightened sense of responsibility to the many constituents who may work very hard or struggle against overwhelming obstacles, but whose incomes are a small fraction of yours. You are the employees of all your constituents, including those who live in poverty, and you must strive without ceasing to meet constituents' needs just as we meet yours. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Jesse Arnold, followed by Michael Kovacs.
Thank you. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. Interesting. I expected to see a lot more people. Usually this subject gets a lot more interest. But anyway, I would like to second the remarks of Eric Greening. And obviously, I want you to be well paid because I want you to do a good job. That's the overall view of, I think, anyone who wants good service from elected officials has to be able to, has to be willing to pay them a decent salary and based on cost of living around here and the amount of the size of the budget that you're responsible for. I think what you're asking for is fair. What I would like to see is, you know, my dad, when I was growing up, used to say, you have to toot your own horn. Nobody is going to toot it for you. And I've seen the board be very bashful. And I don't mean you have to be boastful here, but just I would like to see more of a report on what the board has accomplished, what you are doing for us, and perhaps some comments about how much over 40 hours a week you're putting in to serve your constituents. So in closing, as Eric said, we do need to have more concern for the people at the bottom end of the scale. And so I would like to see this board step up and support a raise in the minimum wage. I think most people feel that if you're working, you should be able to earn enough afford a decent housing, which all too often people on minimum wage can't anymore. So we need to bring up the people at the bottom, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kovacs?
Yes, Michael Kovacs. Firstly, I on this agenda item C1, considering an ordinance amending the county code to increase the Board of Supervisors' salaries by 3.18%. First, I want to say I do support this agenda item. Board members deserve very much this particular pay increase, but I don't understand why wasn't it budgeted? Why is it unbudgeted, just like the $6 million 2 weeks ago has not been budgeted, that was approved by your board 2 weeks ago for staff employees? Another thing is that 20 years ago, when this county used to be number one county, number one, ranking number one in state of California's 58 counties, at that time there was no comparisons made between inter-counties or intra-counties board member salaries. At that time it was set, I believe, at the annual compensation of a judge, 40 grand or what it was a year, I forgot. Now, I resent, and we all, 67% of your constituents, have refused to vote for you largely because of these. We are not listened to, the public, in fiscal matters, including salaries, compensation of staff in particular. We are being ignored. We don't like that. Just because one board in 1998, I don't want to name the chairman of that board, has passed a resolution to adopt these formulas, had conveniently accommodated the annual year-to-year increases. It is your board has the capacity to reverse that resolution. We, the taxpayers, have voted on this issue, overwhelmingly demanding to have the public control your compensation. It was Mickey Mouse-wise invalidated. Our referendum was invalidated, not cancelled out, and not enforced. Well, these are having some heartburns that I had to aerate myself today. But I again repeat, I do support this pay raise for you, but I'd like to have an answer why it wasn't budgeted.
Well, thank you. And that concludes my request to speak forms on this issue. Does anybody, Mr. Ovitt?
Well, I didn't know whether you were going to allow Mr. Edge or not, but in both cases,
put his light up.
the employees' annual COLAs and issues like this are budgeted. However, they're in the contingency fund. Since we have, we don't know specifics. And then if the departments cannot handle it within their own budgets, then the contingency fund takes care of the balance. And that is a budgeted item that we discuss every year.
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do hope that Mr. Edge will answer
his,
that
his light is on.
Question. I just want to comment that I can guarantee that none of us here ran for office for the salary. I don't know that there's enough money really to adequately compensate us for the time and emotional situation that it often causes. I do think that this request for an increase is really part of a process that's predictable and fair. It's consistent with what the county does with its other bargaining units. We are really taking a look at what comparable counties are doing when we adjust compensation. And as Mr. Greek pointed out, even with this increase, we're still about $1,000 a month less than the other comparable counties. So again, it's not about the money. Again, I don't think any of us are here for the money. As Chairperson Bianchi has done in the past, I intend to allocate my increase to District 5 community project funds so we can help utilize that money to support nonprofits in the county. We haven't fully restored the community project funds from what it was historically. The supervisors years ago took a cut in that fund when the rest of the county's departments were taking a hit financially. So I am going to be directing staff to do that with my increase.
Mr. Edge.
Thanks, Madam Chair. What should a supervisor's salary be is a wonderful question to which there are as many answers as there are numbers. Some board members around the state have their salaries set at or as a percentage of a court judge's salary. If you were to set it at that level, that would require about an 80% increase in the salary that we're proposing right now, almost doubling it to what a judge gets. Judges get pay raises doled out by the state on an annual basis, and people who are attached, I worked in a county, Kings County, that attached to a judge's salary, and as you know, every year the board has to have this kind of a hearing. Whether you're attached to a judge's salary or some other form, you still have to adopt this salary change each year because it is an ordinance change. So although you would just come in and say the judge's salary was adjusted by X percent, therefore we will do the same, you still have to have a separate hearing on that. In a county, it was Kings County where I worked, and they were attached as a percentage of a Superior Court judge's salary at the time. The complaint from the public was that they were simply, as board members, using the state as a way of avoiding debating what their salary increase should or should not be. So I think there's a no-win situation in terms of people's perspectives. Using other counties as a comparison is, I think, as good a model and perhaps one of the better models for this kind of salary consideration. It's saying, here's what the marketplace says a supervisor in California is worth. It tracks the same model that you use to calculate any entitlements for COLAs for general employees and other unionized employees and unrepresented employees. And so it has a consistency with the model that you use for us. And obviously, the bottom line is, to the extent that other counties use different kinds of models to set supervisorial salaries, when you are taking the average of a number of counties that use different models, then ultimately you're reflecting the practices of those models. As I said, I don't think that you can convince anybody one way or the other that it's a right or a wrong model. I don't know that there necessarily is one right or any given wrong model. It's simply a process, and I've heard members of the public say the same thing. You need to have a process, I believe, for at least maintaining a salary level for supervisors, which is a full-time job, that is sufficient, not, as Supervisor Patterson said, to have people looking at it as a career move for salary purposes, but at least sufficient so that people can, if they are interested, run and be successful to come onto the Board of Supervisors and not suffer a financial hardship in so doing. So if you like, I think the salary should at least be at a reasonable market level salary for this particular area so that a working person who is inclined to offer him or herself up for public service can do that without saying, I simply cannot afford to give up my current salary and replace it with this level of salary. It is, and one of the members of the audience had asked about you tooting your own horns and the number of hours of work that you put in. It is a full-time job plus, and without pointing out any individual board members and the hours they choose to serve, I will note the multiple evening meetings. I join supervisors on occasions at evening meetings. We have supervisors with multiple advisory committees in their district, and they attend those advisory committees meetings at night, above and beyond having spent a full day in the office. And I also remember discussing a few weeks ago with one supervisor, this person's, I won't designate their gender, this person's weekend calendar that included three events that they were scheduled to be involved in on the Saturday, and then two more events that they were scheduled for on the Sunday, above and beyond the Monday through Friday operation. And so I think as a person who knows the supervisor's calendars better than most members of the public, I can tell people like Jesse who are interested in these things that all of you put in significantly more than a 40-hour Monday through Friday week, and I think that's to the benefit of your constituents. On the question of budgeted versus unbudgeted, Supervisor Overt, who's been around long enough to know this stuff, of course, hit it accurately. We don't budget them in the budget ahead of time because we don't know what the numbers will be, specifically the kind of the timetable for establishing the numbers and the surveys are beyond the time when we are publishing the budget. We do set aside a contingency amount, and the basic process for paying for these things is first, it's the responsibility of the department head to accommodate any salary and benefit increase cost within their adopted budget to the extent that they can. The flexibility that they have that we require them to use is that we also budget full staffing for 12 months, and particularly in larger departments where you have staff turnover, if you have a resignation or a departure of a staff person, you have a vacancy, that vacancy generates salary savings within the total budgeted salaries. The first call on the department is to use those salary savings to offset the additional cost of COLAs. Once that amount has been exhausted, and I think your board is aware, we report to you on quarterly financial reports how we are doing. You're aware that a lot of departments, particularly in this past year, did an outstanding job of eating those additional costs within the original budget, and they deserve kudos for doing that. If they exhaust those savings, or if in a small department, such as the board's budget, which only has the board members, the aides, and a couple of clerical folk, where there isn't any staff turnover, then if the budget is going to go beyond that originally adopted, you have contingencies, and you move contingencies to cover whatever the shortfall is, and that's how you budget for cost of living increases.
Thank you very much. With that, I have one. I personally have a comment. I have no other lights here. And as Mr. Edge was talking, I was thinking everyone ought to be deeply grateful we do not run the county government like a business, or we would all be receiving millions of dollars. So with that, I would entertain a motion.
Make a motion, Madam Chair.
To do what?
I agree with what you're saying.
Okay. I assume the motion is to approve staff recommendation?
Staff recommendation, I'm sorry.
And to waive the reading?
And waive the reading, yes. And may we have a second, please?
I'll second.
May we have a roll call?
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mr. Ashajian?
No.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. Oh, okay. You wanted to say something, Mr. Patterson?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
May we, we'll move on to item C2, please. May we have an introduction?
Item C2 is a hearing to consider an interim ordinance to establish a moratorium on approving new development permits employing transfer of development credit receiving sites in the areas of South Atascadero, Creston, Pozo, and Santa Margarita in the 5th District. This item was introduced on October 18, 2005. Recommendation is for approval and instruct the chairperson to sign.
May we have a staff report, please?
Good morning, Karen Nall with the Planning and Building Staff. Your board directed planning staff to come back from the October 18th meeting and provide you with an interim ordinance that would establish a moratorium on the approval of development permits or other entitlements requiring the use of transferable development credits in the areas of South Atascadero, Creston, Pozo, and Santa Margarita, as defined in the Figure 1, and Andrea's putting a clearer map on, hopefully clearer, on the screen for you. And there's an exception for development permits that are currently in the pipeline or are accepted as of today's date, and we have approximately 7 projects that are in process currently. And that is all I had at this point.
Are there any questions of staff? I see no lights going on. So with that, I will open it to the public. And for those of you who have not been here before, I call one name, and the first person gets to choose the microphone. The second person will go to the alternate microphone. And it helps if you come forward. So the first speaker is Eric Greening, followed by Lynn Miller.
I'm Eric Greening, and I urge you to pass this moratorium. In no way do I speak for the Santa Margarita Advisory Committee, but do regularly attend their meetings as representing District 5 on the Citizens Transportation Advisory Committee. It's good to be there to keep an ear to the ground. So I can share this observation, which is that SMAC's time and energy have been so dominated by one controversial TDC project after another that this ongoing avalanche of TDC projects in their territory is a serious obstacle to their ability to respond and do justice to the many other issues the community is facing. Each agenda is dominated by one or more TDC application, and each one brings a storm of controversy, impassioned members of the public that seem more numerous each month, and protracted, agonized discussion among SMAC members themselves. Members leave meetings late and tired. It would be an act of mercy to give the community a break from these struggles so it can move on to other issues that have been parked on the back burner. If you don't give the community a break, it is quite possible you could soon be confronted with an avalanche of appeals, and then you will experience for yourselves what SMAC has been dealing with. Most of the negative declarations on TDC receiver sites are extremely vulnerable because they show significant cumulative impacts under mandatory findings of significance with no mitigations referenced. What good is a checkmark under impact can and will be mitigated if the mitigation isn't referenced? The SMAC area is feeling picked on. Not one sending site is there, but they are receiving disproportionate impacts from receiving sites. None of these receiving sites represent smart growth or affordable housing. The resulting parcels are all automobile-dependent and adding to pollution and congestion in the area. I recognize that on the 22nd you'll look at the big picture, but in the meantime, you have a community that is pleading for relief. Please show that you are listening. Thank you.
Thank you. Lynn Miller, followed by Dolores Simons.
Good morning, Lynn Miller, Madam Chair, members of the board. I represent the Templeton Area Advisory Group as the vice chair, and we've been dealing with the transfer development credits at some length in our area also. And we would also like to join to make our board part of this motion. We're just having a lot of problems and would like to address it in that manner. It is a major concern to the people in our community. We have over 90 miles of road that we oversee, and the people are very concerned of high-density housing in rural areas. And again, we are a receiver site. We are not a sending site in our district, and would like to have the time, like Napomo has done, to make our own requirements for the use of them in our district. Thank you.
Thank you. Dolores Simons, followed by Maria Lorca.
Dolores Simons of South Atascadero.
Please support the moratorium on the TDCs and drop South Atascadero as a receiving site for TDCs. We wish to keep our zoning of 2.5 acres minimum and the rural atmosphere we had. The deer are already disappearing. I used to have 6 that hung out in my property the majority of the time, and they had their babies in the thicket on the side of my property. About a week ago, excuse me, there was a dead deer at the side of the road just above my property. Della Barrett, who's the advisory representative for our area in the SMAC, has asked me to deliver these 6 letters from neighbors who could not be here today. Thank you.
And thank you. We'll put those in the record. Maria Lorca, followed by Audrey Beatty.
Good morning. Maria Lorca from Creston. First, I would like to thank Supervisor Patterson for going to bat for us on this issue and for his generous donation right now of part of his salary or his salary increase to community projects in District 5. We appreciate him. I'm speaking for our group, Creston Citizens for Agland Preservation, many other citizens in the area around Creston, and people from South Atascadero who couldn't come today in support of this moratorium. It's a very small step that we're asking you to do to restore some integrity to the process. And there is something really very important. I dug out the neg deck that was done for the entire TDC program. It's only 12 pages. It's very boilerplate, but it says here, under growth inducement and cumulative effects, where development potential is relocated from one area to another, the program requires the increased density to be located in a manner that does not result in unavoidable significant environmental effects, including growth inducement. So what we're asking for you to do today is just allow consideration of this, and I think it's an important legal issue. And Supervisor Patterson asked on the 4th County Council to look into a number of other issues, legal issues that we've raised, this being just one of them. And also I would like to ask if we could, if county planning could define for us the moment that a project is accepted as complete for processing. Today you said something about when a project's accepted. That doesn't mean that it just walks in the door. There should be a definite objective time. We'd like to know what the criteria are, who decides, and when that definite point is.
We'll ask staff to comment after public comment.
Thank you very much. And then there's a quick correction. Item D in the ordinance says that staff has been directed to bring forward a number of proposed amendments. We very carefully went through the video of October 4th, and the direction was, and the words are, to bring all the information back for discussion and direction. So staff wasn't directed to create a series of amendments, but to bring everything back that was brought before, especially the Planning Commission, number of issues.
And your
Thank
time
you
is
very
up.
Much.
Thank you. Audrey Beatty, followed by Catherine Sweet.
Madam Chair and Supervisors, my name is Audrey Beatty. I live in Creston. And I'm here as a private citizen, although I do have information from Creston residents that I represent on the SMAC board. I ask you to support the TDC moratorium for Creston, but also for all the SMAC area. Citizens of the areas have requested that you support this. Advisory boards have asked that you support this. And now we are requesting this moratorium, and now we ask you all to support us on this motion. Thank you.
Thank you. Catherine Sweet, followed by Bill White.
Thank you. I'm Catherine Sweet from South Atascadero. Thank you for considering the immediate ordinance to establish a moratorium to stop new TDCs in South Atascadero, Creston, Pozo, and Santa Margarita. As a resident of South Atascadero, I thank you. This action returns us to our area plan overlay of 2.5 acre minimum parcel size. An unintentional consequence of the TDC program allows parcels to be divided into 1 acre lots. This year, an amendment allowing secondary dwellings to be built in South Atascadero did not pass. It was found, and Jim Nall made this finding, that may result in significant impacts associated with traffic circulation and water availability. Therefore, an environmental impact report should be prepared consistent with the requirements of the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, and the CEQA guidelines. TDC homes have the potential to do more cumulative, negative, irreversible damage to the environment and community than a secondary dwelling due to the size of the home and number of possible occupants. Based on Mr. Nall's recommendation, it would be appropriate for you to require an EIR before allowing future development to occur in South Atascadero. This moratorium supports the smart growth principles adopted by this board in June of this year, particularly Guideline 2, preserve open space, farmland, natural beauty, and critical environmental areas. Guideline 3, strengthen and direct development towards existing communities. The moratorium also supports the district's clean air plan. I was very fortunate to hear Erin Arlen-Janay speak about clean air and our county. In response to a question, she explained smart growth takes place first in the cities, the reason being they have water, sewer plants, housing, jobs, alternative transportation, emergency personnel and services, schools, libraries, shopping, entertainment, roads, power, etc. She also explained that buildings in cities need to be multi-level and that most people can accept 3 stories. Over 3 stories, it creates a problem for them. People understand growth is inevitable. However, they want intelligent, planned growth. More than one person told me they do not want San Luis Obispo County to follow in the footsteps of Los Angeles or Orange County with air pollution, overpopulation, and lack of community planning. Thank you to the Board of Supervisors and staff for your time and attention to this project. I also want to state that I just spoke with Cheryl Scott this morning. She owns a parcel of property on San Antonio Road that is right next to a TDC that's in the process. She wants you to know that she supports the opposition to TDCs. She supports this ordinance. She doesn't feel that any of those parcels should be divided below the 5-acre parcel size unless it, you know, for whatever reason it might go to 2.5, but below 2.5 she does not support at all. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill White, followed by Michael Kovacs.
Good morning. My name is Bill White. I live in Templeton. I'd like to voice support for the interim ordinance. Specifically, I'd like to compliment Supervisor Patterson on carefully considering the voluminous testimony and public concern regarding how the TDC program is falling way short of its goals and arguably actually causing sprawl, and then supporting his constituency in proposing the moratorium for 4 towns in the smack area of District 5. However, as pleased as I am that this motion is being considered today, I am extremely disappointed that Templeton has not been included in the proposed moratorium. Templeton has had a well-documented disproportionate problem with receiving site credits. Templeton has absorbed what I believe is the majority of the credits created from the Bonheim Ranch. Templeton has held a public workshop and has heard numerous concerns from the public. Virtually every month, TAG reviews projects with TDC receiver site proposals. TAG wrote a letter dated April 1 to the Planning Commission and a letter dated May 20 to your board requesting, amongst other items, that a countywide moratorium be considered while changes to the full program were being considered. While it is primarily Supervisor Ovitz's responsibility here and act upon Templeton's concerns, but if he will not demonstrate this initiative and support, then the rest of the board also bears equal responsibility for supporting and looking out for Templeton. The board has not done so by not including Templeton in today's proposal. Section 1 of the proposed moratorium, items A through D, could equally apply to Templeton. I therefore would like to formally request that Templeton be added to today's moratorium proposal. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. And we'll respond to that after public comment. Michael Kovacs, followed by Ken Bornholt.
Thank you, Michael Kovacs. 2 weeks ago, I thought that today is going to be a final action by your board on this TDC. I may have misunderstood or whatever, but now I am surprised to read on the today's agenda that you are considering only an interim ordinance. Now, what does that mean, interim? How long? What are the terms of this interim? I'd like to have answered that, please. Now, I am one of the numerous citizens in South Atascadero, Santa Margarita area, who picked this area for retirement and made a move, a substantial, very significant move, to settle down in the South Atascadero area because of the residential suburb zone approximating 2.5 acres per lot, per residence, per parcel. Now, this issue seems to jeopardize this status and condition, and I am urging your board to preserve the current zoning of 2.5 acres that do not authorize of any kind of grannies or whatever kind of gimmicks are used to justify or accommodate the splitting of these 2.5 acres and double or triple the density of the population in the South Atascadero area or, as a matter of fact, any place in our fine county. Thank you.
Thank you. Ken Bornholt, followed by Tina Salter, and that's my last request to speak for.
Madam Chair, members of the board, my name is Ken Bornholt. I'm appearing here today on behalf of my clients, the Bonheim family. The Bonheim family in 1998 was qualified as a cinder site, the entire 7,000-acre ranch. Since that time, they've recorded 2 conservation easements in perpetuity. These easements cannot now be removed from the land. In exchange for these easements, they were given credits by the county, and they were given these credits to sell in their market area. Their market area is restricted to the North County, but it does include the areas of Creston, Santa Margarita, and Atascadero. Those areas would be eliminated from their market if the board adopts the proposed action. They have sold some of their credits. They still hold 42 credits that remain unsold. The fair market value of these credits is approximately $600,000. The sales over the last 7 years have been slow in the market, and it's been slow because of a lack of receiver sites. With the deletion of these areas, we're concerned about an adverse impact by shrinking the market area the Bonheims have available to sell their remaining 42 credits. Having said that, I wanted to make 3 points with respect to the ordinance. 1, I don't believe there's any urgency. I don't think the findings support any urgency to do this now. It takes anywhere from 6 to 9 months to qualify a receiver site. The ordinance is only going to be good for 45 days. Your board is taking up the entire program in 21 days. So I don't see any urgency. Secondly, the approval of a receiver site does not generate any development. The development has to go through the normal CEQA process. The development will address all of the CEQA concerns that are expressed in the findings in your ordinance. That's a development proposal, not a receiver site. Receiver site only establishes the potential for development. So I don't see any connection between a receiver site being created and any immediate threat. Finally, there's a possibly an unintended consequence of you taking this action and shrinking the market area available for the Bonheims to sell their remaining credits. The problem is, if the market becomes inadequate for a sale of these credits, there's a case called Sutum versus Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, a United States Supreme Court decision that involved transfer development credits. The holding of that case was, if the agency that creates these credits in exchange for prohibiting development on the property does not provide an adequate market, there's a potential for an illegal taking, and the agency then becomes liable for the fair market value of those credits.
And thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Tina Salter, and that's my last request to speak for.
My name is Tina Salter, and I live in South Atascadero. And I'm here to encourage you to support this moratorium. Please don't be threatened by potential lawsuits, as the previous gentleman just spoke. I also have talked to very many of my neighbors and have run into hardly any who are for keeping the TDC program as it stands. I know we're going to be back, I believe it's the 22nd of November, to discuss the entire ordinance. And I think that having a moratorium until that time for the, 3 weeks until then, is very appropriate to do at this point, so that then we will be able to discuss the whole ordinance and fix it or eliminate it entirely. Thank you very much.
And thank you for your comments. That concludes the public portion of this item. I'll bring it back. And there were several questions asked. If staff would like to respond to those questions, please.
The first question was to define the acceptance of a permit or land division. Basically, the application has to be found complete by having basic components, meaning maps, reductions, title reports, just a complete application. Then the staff may find that application complete and send the applicant a formal letter. So it's simple as that.
And there were a couple of other questions. I didn't write them down because I assumed you did. Mr. Patterson?
Madam Chair.
Oh, I know what one was. Yeah, Templeton.
Right, and I was just going to point that out. There was a question by two speakers regarding adding the area that the Templeton Area Advisory Group oversees to the moratorium, and that's probably a legal staff question.
Yeah, Mr. Ovitt, and then we'll go back to staff.
Well, I'm going to be a lone voice out here, and first of all, let's take up Templeton. The reason Templeton had TDCs used, and there's two areas that were set aside within the urban area of Templeton, and they were done so by the Salinas Plan. And at that same point, I spoke against applying those because there was no ordinance. And they set a two-year window to put that ordinance up. So here we go by many of the same people who supported the TDC today don't want it. And yet, during that time of the Salinas Plan, we added Templeton specifically in a specific plan. One of those has used it. The others chose not to. The other thing is I tend to agree that the findings really don't support the need for a moratorium. They're based on speculation and emotion. I think they're based on innuendos of things happening when we haven't seen any fact or environmental reasons that can establish what these findings have established. I personally believe moratoriums do not solve problems. And the one thing that kind of brought me to this point at this time is that this board, not more than a week before this request came forward, asked staff to come back for further discussion on what needed to be done with TDCs. It was interesting, somebody said the goals of TDCs. I wonder if they really understand what the goals were. They were not meant to apply to every piece of property in the county. It was a tool for individual use, not across the board. And today, we're sitting here talking about a moratorium in one specific area, and now this emotional run is now saying, well, add me to it or add me to it, which you can't do. You have to go back and notice this whole thing. Instead, I think this board should not pass this moratorium. It should sit down, as was directed to staff, and discuss the pros and cons. Now, it may be that we may limit the program, eliminate it, or we may limit it very strictly, very severely, by requests that have come from these same organizations that are listed in the findings. The last thing is that on that meeting, and the minutes reflect it, there was not support for a moratorium. And yet the next week it comes back, it seems that board members have changed their mind, and we send a mixed message to staff. And what is our staff going to do? Sit down and try to resolve issues or spend its time dealing with the indecision by the Board of Supervisors, in this case, to do a moratorium? I cannot support, nor I will not support, moratoriums and because they do not resolve issues.
Mr. Ashajan would like to make a comment. Before he does, I would like to make a comment that legally we cannot extend this moratorium to another area because, one, it hasn't gone through the Templeton Advisory Council. Two, they haven't passed it. They have not requested it. And it has not gone through the entire process, so we simply can't do that today. But I wanted Mr. White to know that we were not ignoring him because we're not doing Templeton at this time. Mr. Shajan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions, but there was another question asked by audience, member of the audience, the number of the weeks or days for the interim ordinance.
45 days.
This one, excuse me, doesn't this one simply go until November 22nd, and at that time we have the option of extending it 45 days?
No, if I might respond, Karen Nall with planning staff, it's 45 days.
From today?
From today.
Okay.
Wasn't the motion last time to the interim moratorium to be in place till the next scheduled hearing?
John Euphrat, planning staff, and council can jump in as well. As part of our recommendation, we're recommending, one, that you consider and adopt the interim ordinance that would last for 45 days. But the second part of the motion is that you direct us to notice this action for the 22nd of November to consider it for actually extending it for a longer period of time for an additional 22 months. So it's really a two-part action.
It seems like every meeting we're changing something about this issue. And I'd rather stick with what we decided we want to do last time, with the majority of the board deciding to go that way.
Sure.
But I have a couple other questions. To clarify the moratorium, it's only on the receiving site?
John Euphrat, planning staff, yes.
So people can come in on the sending site and go through the process. Does that make sense that we're allowing people to come into the process to ask for them to be the sending side, yet we're saying there won't be any receiving side? Why is it that we're not considering both at the same time? It just doesn't give a clear message to those who are interested to either generate TDCs or receive TDCs. Well, what we're saying during this time, you cannot be a receiver, yet we're generating, and do you follow my level of thinking here?
Sure. John Euphrat, staff. Now, this is a geographic-specific request today. And so, for example, it's a countywide program, and so the sending sites, say, in the South County and receiving sites are still eligible. And so if an applicant wanted to come in today for a sending site in the South County, that would be perfectly appropriate.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but we're not discussing South County because they have a program of their own, and they might choose to stop at a given community, not necessarily for the entire, let's say, South County.
Mm-hmm.
But this is site-specific, and if people come from site-specific to generate TDCs, we're not telling them you cannot do that. But from the site-specific, we're saying that you cannot accept them. So if we're not going to people to purchase a product, why produce the product?
Well, I mean, there are other areas in the North County that are potentially available to receive sending credits.
But wouldn't that be within a certain mile radius?
Well, there's a geographic area. In fact, I've got a map that perhaps we could put up on the board that would show
that. That will be helpful. Thank you. And while she's putting that up, Sir Bonheim, who's been in the system for a long time, within his territory, are there enough applications or interest to finish the 42 credits that he has in place? And if the answer is no, I'll wait for your answer. Can we then revisit and reestablish his development rights, just to be fair to all concerned?
Any pending applications?
We can speak to the total amount of pending projects that we have in currently. Just to give you some numbers, total in process is 13.
Okay.
In the South Atascadero area, in the moratorium area.
Total in process meaning that there will become sending sites or
receiving? No, receiving sites.
Okay, thank you for. I think she said just south of Atascadero.
Did you say?
In the moratorium area.
In the moratorium area.
Seven
okay.
There. 13 total. Seven
at Atascadero. Yeah, in the specifically south of Atascadero, we have seven pending applications.
For receiving site.
For receiving sites.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Mr. Shajan?
Yeah, I just want to see if there was a balance of what we have for sale and how many customers we have waiting, and what we encourage somebody to do in the past. If now we say your product is like technologies, we got something new in place, or we were going to treat that property owner fairly.
Okay, does that conclude your?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson, followed by Mr. Linthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The purpose of the moratorium for the Santa Margarita Area Advisory Committee region of jurisdiction is because over the course of the past couple of years, it actually began with a letter from the Creston Citizens for Ag Land Preservation in January of 2004. So it's been almost 2 years since this issue has been discussed among the citizenry of Pozo, Creston, South Atascadero. And the concern is that the credits were being used in a way that was unintended, particularly in South Atascadero. The community did not have an opportunity to weigh in on what would be an appropriate use for the TDC credits, as communities in other parts of the county have, Napomo specifically, and the Cambria area, which have community-based TDC programs. And what was happening in South Atascadero particularly was that with an area plan overlay of a minimum parcel size of 2.5 acres, people were using the TDC program to split those minimums below the area standard to 1 to 1.5 acre parcels. And so it was really changing the character of the neighborhood. And what this board did just back in June was deny the opportunity for residents in South Atascadero to build second units because of the potential environmental impacts of allowing additional growth in South Atascadero, because there were concerns about water, there were concerns about roads and traffic, as well as the change in character of the neighborhood, which has, again, a 2.5 acre minimum single residence. And this board found at that time that it wouldn't be appropriate to allow secondary units without moving forward with an environmental impact report. This board also stated that there was not overwhelming community support or area support for secondary units. Well, those same conditions exist. There is not overwhelming support for the use of TDCs to actually create new lots, which would have a greater impact on the resources and on the character of the neighborhood than secondary units would. So we're being consistent with this moratorium to have the opportunity to, number one, evaluate the program. I want to point out that the Ag Liaison Board, the Ag Commissioner's Office, a number of area advisory committees, as well as a number of citizens groups, and the County Planning Commission has recommended that there be an area-wide or countywide moratorium on the use of these TDC credits until this board has had an opportunity to thoroughly evaluate the program. And since there was not support for a countywide moratorium, and because a majority of these requests were coming into the Creston area and also the South Atascadero area, I move forward, and also because the Santa Margarita Area Advisory Committee for almost 2 years have heard issues regarding the TDC program and have repeatedly advised that we adopt a moratorium and thoroughly review the TDC program. I'm carrying their wishes forward. As Supervisor Ovett pointed, that it is involving emotion and innuendo and not fact. Well, the fact is that we are dividing parcels below the area minimum. We have serious resource issues in South Atascadero, primarily water, roads, and traffic. This is based on fact. Facts that the board used is relevance for not moving forward with a secondary unit ordinance in South Atascadero. Those same conditions apply here. Now, the interim ordinance, if adopted today, would prevent any more applications going through or being accepted for processing. And currently, there are a number of applications that have been accepted for processing that will continue to move through the process. And it's my understanding, as of yesterday, that all applications had been accepted as complete and will move through the process. So there's nobody hanging out there now that would be impacted by this. At our hearing on November 22nd, we will hear back from planning staff on the TDC program. At that time, we can extend this moratorium if we need more time, and I think it will take more time. I don't expect us to solve the TDC ordinance problem on November 22nd. I think it will take more time, and we have the opportunity at that meeting to extend this moratorium so the community has an opportunity to weigh in, so we have an opportunity to address the concerns that were universally expressed by most of the county's advisory committees, the planning commission, ag liaison, ag commissioner, that this ordinance needs to be reevaluated. It's not accomplishing the goals that it was set out to accomplish, and we need to rethink it. The first thing we do is we stop the hemorrhaging. We stop the abuses that are occurring in the area within the Santa Margarita Area Advisory Council's jurisdiction, and that's what this ordinance is all about. And I respectfully ask the board to give the people that live within this area the opportunity to have their concerns heard and be a part of the process of fixing the ordinance.
I have more speakers. Mr. Lenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to follow up. I believe it was part of one of Supervisor Asagi's questions about being consistent here and clear. My recollection, and I also reviewed the tape, is we were talking about applications or projects that were in the pipeline. Now, we had a couple of emails come in yesterday because there was some confusion from people that said, I paid my fees, I was in the pipeline, but I haven't received this document from Environmental Health, I haven't received this form from somebody else. Am I in the pipeline? Am I improved? Do I become subject to this ordinance or what? So I would hope that we're going to be able to answer a couple of those questions. And in being consistent and fair, in reading this, it says, now applications that have been determined by the Department of Planning and Building to be complete for processing on or before this date. So that language is different than what I recall we were talking about as far as something's in the pipeline. And my question is, if someone paid their fees to start a process and there was a letter or something that hasn't been finalized from other departments, are they in the pipeline? Are they subject to this? And I recall when I asked the question, I don't think there was a large number. I want to say it was around 8 or 9 that you thought they were out there in this no man's land or in the black hole. And then now we hear that we have 13 total planned, 7 for Atascadero, and I guess, Ms. Nall, I'd like you to start, if you can help answer those questions for me as far as defining what is the what is in the pipeline or versus what is approved, because this was the subject of some confusion. I appreciate your email at 4:21 yesterday on one specific project that said that, yes, they did get their final letter to come in, but I do believe there's some other people out there that are kind of feeling like they're left in limbo right now.
And our last count last evening was 7 projects that were in the pipeline. All have been accepted for processing, which is synonymous with complete. So we use those terms.
And they have been notified?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Shajan?
Thank you. I don't think I have a disagreement in the big picture that you're trying to bring to the screen here. But just like I heard today, that have been so many applications, were those as a sending sites or receiving sites?
All receiving sites.
All receiving sites, okay. And what I think I would have rather done, but I will stick with my decision-making process, that if we were to put an interim moratorium, the only reason, as I talked with Mr. Patterson about this, I went ahead supported it with some hesitance because we were going to come back to reevaluate, and I thought maybe the gain and the loss won't be that great to wait a few more weeks out of respect to the district's wishes. So what I can support today is what we supported last time and not change that. But I want a personal direction or a question or comment to the staff that if we're going to put an interim moratorium from the receiving side, it should also apply from sending side so that we're not misleading anybody, bringing them into the process to say, yes, you can generate sites, but you know what, we're not going to receive anything. Then why put them through the process and through the expenses if that happens to be the case? If somebody was to rush to say, well, they're going to stop this and I want to become a sending site, and knowing that there's going to be a possible changes of the receiving side, and why put the folks through the expenses and the hassle of going through the process. I just don't see us doing that. But since I went ahead and supported it to November 22nd, I don't mind keeping that direction as given to the staff, because we will reevaluate, and that's only 21 days away.
Mr. Ovitt, and then I have a comment at the very end, a brief comment.
I just want to bring up two points. The first one, when Pomo had an issue with the TDC, and it's been bounded around here that they got a community plan, we didn't go through a moratorium in Pomo. We basically sat down. There was a plan put together by the community and brought forward and added to the TDC ordinance. Templeton, shortly after that, asked to do the same thing. However, I've not seen that come forward, and it seems to have died, and I don't know why. And so I want you to understand that these communities now all of a sudden that are talking about TDC, some have not even chose to try to find a community plan that works, but have chose to basically just stop everything. And we were talking about looking at community plans for individual areas as opposed to the total moratorium. The other thing that needs to be changed is Section 3 in this ordinance says this will stay in effect not to exceed 45 days. It doesn't say anything about the 22nd. It only refers to the 22nd in the findings that says that we will bring this part of the that there is a further public hearing regarding the transfer development on the 22nd, but does not limit this to the 22nd. It is 45 days, and that is by ordinance.
Mr. Ashajan.
Thank you. Since Nipomo being brought up, it's a lot of credit to the folks in Nipomo. Those of you that wish to have a community-based TDC, it's not an easy job. It takes a lot of commitment from those who have put their heart into the system and work very, very hard to make it their own. And it's probably one of the best, even though if their wishes are to stop it on November 22nd, I don't have a problem doing that if that's their wishes. But if you speak to NCAC and also Land Conservancy, who work in partnership and harmony, probably the best thing ever happened since TDC came to its existence. But, again, I'll follow their wishes. But today, Supervisor Patterson, since this is in your district, and we made a decision, good or bad, last Tuesday. I'll stick to the 22nd if that's any of your liking. But I think I will keep my efforts to reevaluate the entire TDC as it comes in front of us, and I'll be very, very careful to see how many we have in the sending and how many in receiving, because I don't want to overcrowd the market when there is no need for the product we're putting out there. So I don't want to mislead those who have come through the process and trust their government that will be there to support their rights.
Mr. McNulty.
Madam Chair, I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. I just wanted to address the issue about the expiration date. The Section 3 of the ordinance on page C-2-4 does refer to the length of the ordinance as not to exceed 45 days. That's the longest amount of time that the statute allows you to have an interim ordinance. If it was the wish of the board to reduce that amount of time to the 21 days that I've heard a discussion about, you could do that without need to further notice. You could just simply change the 45 to 21, would accomplish the same purpose. The ordinance would then expire on November 22nd, absent some further action by your board at that point to extend it.
Okay, so that if we changed it to 21 days, on November 22nd, we could extend it for 45 if we wished.
Yes, the way the staff report is prepared, the second recommendation, the first is to adopt the interim ordinance. The second recommendation is to have your staff notice that hearing on November 22nd to allow an extension of the interim ordinance. So your board will be set on that day to decide whether or not to extend it or not extend it.
Okay, thank you. And the last comment I would like to make is that after all my years of listening to public testimony, I have come to the conclusion that everyone, including all members of the board, believe passionately in what they're saying. So we're all emotional. And so I don't believe that we can use emotion as a cause to support or deny something. Mr. Patterson, I hope you're going to make a motion.
Madam Chair, just before that motion, John Euphrat, Planning Staff, you had asked us to respond to
yes.
There were two questions, I think, that needed to be responded to. One was from a member of the public, and it dealt with on the staff report of page 3, item D, where it indicates as part of the section 1 that the board directed staff to bring forward a number of proposed amendments. And in reality, I mean, we're not – at the hearing on the 22nd, there will not be a hearing to change the transfer of development credit program other than this urgency ordinance. So I just wanted to clarify that. And the second thing, just to fully underscore when Supervisor Linthal asked to double-check, that there are applications that are pending, but they are all accepted for processing. So the 7 or 8 that are in the office are okay and will not be affected by today's action. So just to clarify, there's no one that we're aware of that's in the office that would be affected.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to publicly thank all the people that have worked for the past 2 years on the TDC program, and they've been thorough and efficient and have really, I think, raised the level of scrutiny of the program through the various advisory committees, and I think in the end we'll have a good result and hopefully end up with a transfer of development credit program that does what it's intended to do without adversely impacting communities that are currently receiver sites, or certainly allow an opportunity for those communities to weigh in on how the TDC program can be used in their neighborhoods. With that, I want to emphasize that there are two parts to this motion. The first being to adopt the interim ordinance, and the second to direct staff to advertise a public hearing for November 22nd, at which time this ordinance would again be considered for termination or extending. So I will make that motion.
Waive the reading.
Waive the reading.
Thank you.
Is there a second? Okay, I'll second it. May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Patterson?
Before we can we have a discussion so I have a better understanding of the motion made?
Yes.
this does not include the timing of when, as November 22nd?
No. He did not change the motion. He did not change any language in the ordinance in his motion.
Okay.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mr. Ovid?
No.
Mr. Shajian?
No.
Mr. Lenthal?
Yes.
I believe the motion fails. Isn't it a four-fifths motion?
Yep. Yeah.
Yes, it requires a four-fifths vote because it's an interim ordinance.
The motion fails.
Want to put the 22nd?
Yeah, if you...
We still have a meeting on the 22nd.
Right.
We're still having the meeting on the 22nd. If Mr. Patterson would consider a motion to make this a interim ordinance until November 22nd, at which time we could reconsider the time limit.
And that is what we did last
Tuesday. That essentially was the motion. I don't quite understand what
I asked for the date, and it wasn't included.
It wasn't specific enough.
Actually, I think specific. That Mr. McNulty suggested in Section 3, if you change to not exceed 45 days to not exceed 21 days, that addressed Supervisor Ashaji.
November 22nd, as we said last time we're going to do, and I'm just trying to be consistent with what we said and follow through. And on the 22nd...
I'll agree with that. Part 2 of the recommendation is that we hear it on November 22nd.
I realize, but I just want...
The microphone's not on, Jim.
I just want staff to be as confused as I am. Maybe they're not. But if we give a date specific, then it's in the record, and we all have the same understanding.
That the interim ordinance will be in place until November 22nd, at which point in time we will reconsider the 45-day extension, a 45-day extension.
John Ufrat, planning staff. I believe we're clear, and we'll be preparing a public notice that stipulates to that.
Okay. Do you wish to make that a second motion, Mr. Patterson?
Well, I do, but I'd like to get clarification from county council because it wouldn't be another 45-day extension. As I understand, the interim ordinance requirements or statute that initially it's 45 days maximum. We're saying 21 days, at which point we'll consider the extension for up to 22 months. But we can choose any time within that 22-month period, I presume.
That's correct. Let me address both those issues. First, if the board prefers to have the interim ordinance extend only until November 22nd,
right,
it should change Section 3 in the ordinance on page C-2-4. It currently reads, this ordinance shall remain in effect for a period not to exceed 45 days from adoption or until superseded and replaced by another ordinance duly adopted by the Board of Supervisors. If you change the 45 days to 21 days, then the ordinance will be in effect until November 22nd. Now, the board, as part of its motion here today, is continuing this item till November 22nd and asking its staff to advertise the potential extension of the interim ordinance. Under the statute that allows for interim ordinances, the interim ordinance can be extended at that time up to an additional 22 months and 15 days. So the board can decide on November 22nd how much longer it wants to extend or whether it wants to have it end entirely on that day.
But if I may, Madam Chair, isn't 22nd is scheduled for us to revisit TDCs for re-evaluation? And while we're evaluating that, then maybe moratorium be part of the re-evaluation. So and that was my whole thing, that if you choose to have to 22nd, and I'd rather see it applied to both ends of the equation here, receiving and sending, and that's the date that we were going to do, hopefully, our major decision as, is it working, it's not working, what kind of changes you want to see for this, let's say, for District 5, as we have done, not for the District 4, but for the community of Nipomo. And that was gearing us to look into it and learn from staff and maybe those who would email us and try to educate us. That was what I was gearing for the last Tuesday, that this was the date. It wasn't 21 days or 25 days or 45 days. It was up to the date that the hearing item was scheduled to be in front of us, and then we're going to make some decisions that if moratorium was it for the rest of its life, that's fine. But I don't want to mislead myself and those who are trying to follow our footsteps to say, you said that last Tuesday, we didn't come based on that. And you're going to listen to the entire hearing of the TDCs at large on the 22nd, then let's go to that date and decisions will be made from that date forward.
Right. I think Mr. Patterson is ready to make that motion.
With that in mind, I would like to amend the motion, Madam Clerk, to read on page C24, section 3, 21 days.
And actually, you're making a new motion because the prior motion failed.
Oh, you're right. I'll move that we adopt the interim ordinance contingent on returning to the board on November 22nd to, again, hear the TDC program and consider extending the motion or the ordinance at that time. And I would also like to direct staff to provide notice that we will be hearing the ordinance again on November 22nd.
And waive the reading again.
And waive a reading.
And waive the reading.
Is there a second?
Second.
May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
No.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. And with that, this board desperately needs to take a 15-minute break. We will return at 11:15. Item D1, please.
Item D1 is consideration of a request for changes to the California Vehicle Code prohibiting the use of off-highway all-terrain vehicles on California public lands to persons younger than 14 years of age.
And may we have a staff report, please.
Madam Chair, Vince Marici with the County Administrative Office. I have a few brief introductory remarks for this item. Your board previously approved a request by Dr. Larry Foreman to make a presentation to you about his proposal to change the California Vehicle Code. The County Health Commission has supported Dr. Foreman's request and also requested that your board hear and consider Dr. Foreman's proposal, and that's the topic here today. Dr. Foreman is an emergency room physician at the Arroyo Grande Hospital. He proposes to change the California Vehicle Code to add age restrictions on the use of off-highway vehicles and ATVs on California public lands. Under the current California Vehicle Code, Section 38503, persons under 18 must meet one of three criteria to be able to operate an all-terrain vehicle on public lands. They must either be taking a prescribed safety training course under the direct supervision of a certified all-terrain vehicle instructor, be in possession of an appropriate certificate issued by this state or another state. Many states like California have certificate programs that require younger riders to take courses that teach safety and proper technique for riding ATVs, or be under the direct supervision of an adult who has an appropriate training certificate issued by the state or under the authority of another state. In addition, people under the age of 14 must meet one of the previously identified criteria and must also be accompanied by and under the direct supervision of a parent or guardian or under the direct supervision of an adult authorized by the parent or guardian. Dr. Foreman's proposal would change the California Vehicle Code so that no person under the age of 14 years shall operate an off-highway vehicle or all-terrain vehicle on California public lands. The staff report has outlined the general positions both in favor and opposed to Dr. Foreman's request. It's important to keep in mind that any change to the state vehicle code would have to be approved at the state level. Essentially, Dr. Foreman's request is for your board's support to change state law. The staff report also outlines several options that range from taking no action to supporting Dr. Foreman's request or supporting a modified version of his request. Staff recommendation is that following the testimony that you'll hear presented today, your board provide direction to staff as to what your desired action is. Dr. Foreman is here to make his presentation to the board. In addition, I'd also note that we have Andrew Zilke, the district superintendent from Oceano, Dunes State Vehicle Recreation Area here. We have Bill Vail, the commander of the Highway Patrol, San Luis Obispo area in the audience. And we have representatives from the Friends of the Oceano Dunes, a group that supports both the Oceano Dunes and the off-road motor vehicle recreation allowed there. That really concludes my introductory remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions that your board may have.
Are there any questions of Mr. Marici? I see no lights.
I would like to congratulate Mr. Marici for learning new level of abbreviations. The wordings are just to read. I came across so many that I get more in this report than the 6 years, 10 months, and one day that I've been here.
Yeah, there are a number of abbreviations in the report. Yeah, but just coming from emergency planning, I'm used to it. But.
Okay, with that, we'll open it to the public, and Dr. Foreman can have 5 minutes to make his presentation. Mr. Zilke can have 5 minutes to make his presentation, and everyone else gets three. So, Dr. Foreman, you're going to be speaking for Dr.
I am Dr.
You're Dr. Foreman. I'm sorry. You look different here than you did upstairs.
Suit.
Probably it.
Well, first off, my name is Dr. Larry Foreman. I'm an emergency physician, both at Arroyo Grande Community Hospital as well as French Hospital Medical Center. And first off, I'd just like to really thank Madam Chair, other board members, Vince. I appreciate this so much. For me, it's a way of informing elected officials as well as the public of my concerns and turns out other concerns of other people. Another thing that's really important here, I tend to talk fast. It's kind of nature of my business. So if I talk too fast, please, please slow me down because I'm going to take about a 30-minute thing and try to condense it into about 5 minutes. Mr. Marici pointed out, this is a trying to elicit your support for amending current California Vehicle Code, which in my opinion has been horribly ineffective. It was enacted and started in 1990 and basically ignored. And not because of just general, lack of wanting to do it by park rangers and like that, but because it was just such a bad law. As it stands now, they have to actually cite and even arrest little kids. And just people don't want to do that. And I wouldn't want to do that. So it's just a very, very horrible law. One of the parts of the law says that you have to have an ATV safety certificate. And the problem is that these safety certificates they're unavailable almost. I mean, I went online last night to find out if I could get a safety certificate. And lo and behold, the closest one was in San Miguel. The rest of them are in the valley, and this is within a 150-mile radius of the San Luis Obispo zip code. So they're just not offered. Now, one of my proposals is that the educational part of this be greatly expanded. I'm a huge believer in education. I mean, that has to happen. That's a huge problem there. Another problem is adult supervision. And I hear it all the time for people saying that, not my kids, I'm constantly supervising. And I'm sure they are. And there is a tremendous number of adults out there supervising and taking care. There's no doubt in my mind. The real problem, though, is the numerous adults and parents out there who don't look after their kids. And I want people to understand that this is not just my observations. I request that you, members of the public, go out to the dunes, preferably on a weekend, and preferably like on a holiday weekend, and you'll see for yourself that there is a problem. You will see little kids, especially on the sand highway, that are dodging cars, ATVs, trucks, horses, motorcycles. They are literally dodging, and they're like little kids with, you know, deer in the headlights kind of thing. Do I go left? Do I go right? And these people are not being supervised. The adults, you know, they're out having fun out in the dunes and like that, so it's a huge problem. There's some other things with the amended law that I would really like to see. Now, the age 14 or under 14, that's pretty well known. And I really do feel strongly that we need to enforce the educational part of this and the availability of ATV safety certificates. Now, the one that's actually promoted by the ATV Safety Institute, which I might add is a direct arm and extension of other ATV manufacturers, that they do have specific recommendations. Unfortunately, it's not followed all the time. And in fact, is about 87% of injuries to kids is from them riding too big of machines. And as it stands right now, there is no maximum size. Look in the vehicle code. You won't find it. So that literally the 4-year-old, if they're capable of reaching the controls, could be out riding a 250 or 500cc machine. And these machines go 70 miles per hour. They weigh hundreds of pounds, 500 pounds or more at times. And so, you know, these are not toys. And yet they get treated as toys by kids sometimes. There's one other thing, and again, I'm just an emergency physician, but I look for guidance from elected officials, highway patrol, as far as the enforcement issue, because it is a huge problem. And they have mentioned about, you know, citing, and that's about the only way you have to have a stick, and that is citing, you know, the adults who are supposed to be supervising. And also I would propose that whoever is writing these...
Unfortunately, your time is up.
Can we ask questions?
Yes, but you can stay there, and Mr. Shajan has a question.
Dr. Foreman, first of all, I want to thank you for your efforts. I think it is a concern and needs to be addressed somehow. But according to the Tribune article on July 10, at that time, you have not received any response from our state level where the law has to really kick in if it was so desired at that level. Now, some 4 months after, have you heard anything, or can you tell us what kind of response you received on the state level?
I was advised by their legislative aides that I needed to do more homework, and she suggested that I contact, you know, you find people, fire chiefs, various agencies, get more support, that I can't just go out and just kind of do this on my own. So that's one of the things I've been doing. The other reason I've actually delayed meeting with Mr. Blakesley and Mr. Maldonado is that the legislation won't be in session until January. And so I've actually had some time to kind of refine, you know, my request, as well as to approach members of the public, both elected and not. And so that is one of the reasons my goal is to meet with them later this month now, when I have, if you will, more ducks lined up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And don't go away. I mean, you could sit down, but don't leave, because undoubtedly there will be more questions. So the next speaker is Mr. Zilke. And I'm sure you have a title, but it's not on your yellow slip, and so I don't know what it is.
Park Ranger.
Okay. Followed by Jim Sudi.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and members of the Board of Supervisors. First, I'd like to say that the Department of Parks and Recreation is very much against legislation that restricts those under the age of 14 from operating off-highway motor vehicles within the state lands, particularly the state vehicular recreation areas. Essentially, that type of legislation would be, although well-intended, another difficult one to enforce based upon rider safety gear that the riders would wear, would give the officers no indication of those who may be under or over 14, especially when you start approaching 12, 13-year-old age brackets. I have read the staff report, and I am in favor of two of the possible options, one in that the board either take no action, or two, the board supports legislation to require a vehicle code statute for adult supervision of minors. We feel that that would be an important tool for our law enforcement contingent to help bring the issue into better control. In the staff report, there's mention of statistics relative to the Consumer Product Safety Board, and I would have to say that those are national statistics. All states relate to all forms of activity off-highway. California's state vehicular recreation areas, SVRAs, are well below the average, less than 2 injury accidents of all kinds per 10,000 ATVs. Our fatality rate for that age bracket is zero and has been zero in the SVRAs and Oceano Dune for years. So I think we operate and have demonstrated that the state parks operate a very safe environment. Legislation, as Dr. Foreman proposes, would force families to go to areas where those restrictions would not apply. Federal properties, Forest Service, BLM properties that already provide 90% of the off-highway vehicle recreation in the state of California would be increasingly used by these parties that may well feel that the restrictions within the state-owned properties, particularly the SVRAs, are too strict. So my thought is give us tools that we can use as law enforcement. Obviously, as already spoken about the ATV certificate program, there's been problems with the program. It's a difficult law to enforce, although we still enforce it. In the letter that I wrote to you, officers have made thousands of contacts since our target period started in January 1st, literally over 4,000 contacts focused law enforcement, including the adult supervision issue. And what we do is we spend a lot of time. We stop the children, take the children back to their campsite or to their adult sponsor, and counsel them regarding the law and the ATV certificate program. It takes a lot of time. Sure, a citation isn't issued, but the law is effectively enforced. So I'll open it for questions.
Mr. Lenthal first, Mr. Shajan, then Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent Zilke, with the resources you have, can you address the issue or the concerns of not having the adequate training or having the opportunity for the training sites to take place in the area? And specifically, if someone comes from the Valley, they're vacationing here, they haven't had the opportunity to take a class somewhere else, is there something that we can do, that you can do, that we can all do collectively to ensure that these classes are available and maybe in a more timely fashion?
Yeah, the ATV certificate program over the years since 1990 has come and gone. The contract has expired. Now it's just been renewed since the last year. And as you saw in my letter, over 500 kids have been trained through that process. In terms of availability, in addition to what Dr. Foreman mentioned regarding actual sites where classes are scheduled, it is also scheduled based upon demand. So if there's a tremendous demand out of the Oceano Five Cities area, then the ASI will listen to that demand and schedule a class. We have ASI-certified instructors on staff. We provide training to at-risk youth already through the schools annually, and during this period of time, several times a month. So we're already dealing with that issue locally, and all the SVRAs are providing the same type of experience. So in addition, State Parks is paying for the training for all those under the age of 17 at our cost. So there's no cost to those youngsters doing that. So the issue is of importance here really is we agree, and we are concerned about safety, and that's why the state SVRAs are the safest place of this type to recreate for off-highway motor vehicle recreation.
Supervisor Shajan.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Zilke. In a staff report, the following size up motorcycle to comparison to the age is a guideline on D14 where it says 8.6 and older under 70 cc's. These are just guidelines. Can you enforce those, or
no? Those are manufacturer recommended guidelines. Actually, it's posted and stamped on all the ATVs relative to not to operate a vehicle under a certain age and whatnot. The law that we do enforce and can enforce is that where the youth is unable to reach and operate all the controls of the vehicle. So that's basically the only thing that's enforceable in the vehicle code.
A few other questions, if I may, Madam Chair. One of the options we have says wait till the completion of the course review of the superintendent's order to place responsibility on parents, guardians, and authorized adults. When do you expect to hear something about that?
Well, as a division, we met on Friday, myself, our deputy director of the Off-Highway Motor Vehicle Division, our division chief, and our legislative office with regard to amendments to the California Vehicle Code 38,000 section, which is primarily the off-highway vehicle section, as the remedy to do just that, so it would become statute. The superintendent's orders, we're pulling that concept back because it's not intended to be a long-term solution. So our feeling is we'll approach it through the statute to do that, and it'll become an amended section of the 38,000 section. So that's going to move forward this year to committee and looking for sponsorship from legislation.
One of the options that, well, this wasn't one of the options that you included, but it is a support a revised proposal to establish a different age limit or add age-based vehicle size restriction on ATV use, which is the guidelines. If the manufacturer is recommending a size to go with age and we ignore that, are we doing something wrong here?
Well, you know, I don't know. That in terms of their recommendations, I think that's through their product testing they feel comfortable with from their own liability standpoint. But in terms of enforcement, you kind of have to put yourself in the place of a law enforcement officer when you start making very fine-tuned restrictive legislation. It becomes very difficult to enforce, like, well, how old is that child? And you really don't have probable cause to stop someone to determine their age, their relative to the equipment, whether they have a certificate or a license, that type of stuff. There has to be something else going on there to cause you to do that. Then you can deal with it. So my thought is try to initiate legislation that really has an ability to be adequately enforced and is easy to do that. Our officers in the field are finding, because they're spending so much time dealing with the youth rider unsupervised, and they're spending so much time taking them back and counseling parent, that there isn't anything in place that currently makes the parent responsible, unless, of course, there's a catastrophic or major event that occurs, then, of course, parents are responsible for their children. And we want to stop it well short of that.
I look at it as being familiar with the area and having served on the Royal Randy Hospital Board for 11 years and don't want to take it away from family fun, but I can also see a family fun ending up being a family tragedy. It's always a hard balance to maintain,
right.
But we'll see where we go with it. Thank you. Yes. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Mr. Patterson has a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent Zilke, you've made reference to the fact that the state parks operate a very safe environment for off-highway vehicles, and that if it became too restrictive, people would go to other venues to ride and potentially be more at risk. And the implication was, at least as I heard it, that the California Vehicle Code wouldn't necessarily, or the same rules enforced in state parks wouldn't necessarily be enforced on federal lands, BLM land or Forest Service. The vehicle code doesn't apply to those lands.
Vehicle
if this
code
were in the vehicle code, would it still be enforceable on federal land?
The vehicle code is enforceable on highways within federal land. The federal officers are not empowered to enforce the California Vehicle Code. On or off highway, unless they have an MOU and are deputized by a local county sheriff. And as far as I know, San Luis Obispo County does not have that relationship with the federal agencies, nor does very many. So the short answer would be no, there is not an ability to enforce the vehicle code unless so authorized to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
That's the last question, so we'll open it to the rest of the public. Thank you for your time. I lost the. Hang on a minute. I turned it over. Mr. Jim Sudi, followed by Kevin Rice. And if Mr. Rice would come forward to the alternate microphone, it saves time.
Good morning. My name is Jim Sudi. I'm the president of Friends of Oceano Dunes. I believe I have 3 minutes to speak, so I'm going to kind of talk very fast. I provided a handout today. I'm definitely not going to talk to all these charts, but I briefly want to bring something to the attention. My family's been enjoying this park since I was a twinkle in my daddy's eye. Started riding at the age of 6 on the old ATC three-wheeler, big tires. That was before safety equipment. That was before helmets and the boots and the riding gear. I've ridden my entire life. I've never been injured. I'm raising two boys now who have started writing at a very early age. You see the picture about on page 2. It shows me out there training my children how to ride. You can see the date on it. This wasn't fabricated for this event. We spent a great deal of time educating our children. On the bottom of page 3, we try to look at the numbers. Earlier, talking about salaries, and you compare and you contrast to other counties. Well, where's the comparison and contraction here for the injury rates? There's no data. Dr. Foreman, unfortunately, presents one piece of paper. There's no data to support this. Where's the data? How do we know about these injuries that occurred? Can we look at each one and figure out what caused it? Was it their experience level, size of ATV, their supervision, riding the proper gear, the conditions that they're riding? Where's the evidence? Where's the data? Let's look at it. I'm game to look at it. ATVs are not supposed to be babysitters. It's a thing that you have to be very responsible as a parent, just as you own a swimming pool in your backyard. You don't let your child out there unsupervised. ATVs are the same way. You folks have asked some very eloquent questions about the size and everything else, and unfortunately I don't have my time to do it. I'd love to have some questions on it when the time comes. But when you look at the numbers, there's a 99.92% success rate and a 0.08% failure rate. And that's the bottom of page 3. You can see the math and how we come about those numbers. That is underestimated probability of success. We do not have an epidemic. We do not have a problem. Like any society, culture, neighborhood, any problem, you always have an element that stands out and unfortunately gets the bad element takes away from the good element. Families are out there having fun, spending time together. The numbers don't support this drastic action. I am in support of citing the parents if they are not supervising their children. This is about parents taking responsibility for their children. I'll go on and on, but let me just say that I'm here to answer any of your questions. I take this issue very personal. I represent 27,000 members who enjoy this park, and we want to make sure it stays open for all to enjoy. Thank you.
Mr. Shajan has a question.
If I may, please. I hear what you're saying, and it makes a lot of sense. As a father, you're taking that responsibility, and that's where I differentiate between family fun and family tragedy. Accidents happen. The area that you were had your pictures, is that an area? Was a ribbon going around that was just restricted for training? Right.
One of the things that, to answer that, Dr. Form was trying to paint a picture of this reckless environment where kids are dodging in and out, left and right, not wanting to go. You know, there might be a few strays out there doing that and a few irresponsible parents doing that. But the majority of parents build tracks in little areas roped off with inside their camp so they can supervise right there in place. My family has 3 generations of camp there, and the grandparents love to sit out there and watch and be a part of it and share the stories and roast marshmallows afterwards. It's much more than what is being portrayed here. And unfortunately, we're not getting a fair shake. A
couple more questions, if I may. One, do you give your children the size appropriate to their age? Does that occur in your training or just for our understanding?
Absolutely. The size of the ATVs, Mr. Foreman was talking about having kids on these large ATVs that can do 70 miles an hour. Well, unfortunately, that's not always true because those motorcycles have to go fast. You have to shift gears. Little kids can't shift the gears and operate the clutch and do all those activities. It just doesn't happen. My children, the picture there, my youngest boy Josh is on a 60cc Yamaha Trisinger, automatic bike. When you teach your kids, I started teaching them to ride at the age of 2. Let me tell you what that means. That means you spend 20 minutes putting all their riding gear on. You go out and you put them on their ATV. They ride 3 feet and they say, I'm done. They want to go back inside and watch Barney. That's what that means. These motorcycles are designed. You have throttle governors on the throttle so they don't go very fast. You have ropes behind them so the parents run around. And so if the child gets out of control, you pull the rope and it kills the engine instantly. Both those ATVs that you've seen in those pictures have those controls. But my kids have been riding so very long that I'm able to let them ride free without the throttle governor and without the pull cord on them. They will not do 60 miles an hour.
Let me ask you my final question. And again, following what you're saying, there are parents will put it into good use and there are parents will probably abuse the system. Let's go beyond that age that your children are. Maybe they are now. I don't know when the pictures were taken. Would it be right to say that there are areas where you have teenagers from 13 and up or even maybe 11, 12 that they have the ATVs and they go co-mingle or mix with dune buggies and probably where some of the accidents takes place? And, of course, some people will drink and then drive and go through their wild adventure.
Right, and unfortunately, since we don't have the incident reports and the data to go look at that to see what caused the accidents, we can't make those determinations.
Well, I wonder if the report will be confidential, that we're not going to be able to get that, so I don't know.
So then it becomes a trust me. So why don't we let maybe the doctor and Andrew Zilke sit down and compare the OHV incident reports from the park and to what the doctor's report is. I don't need to be part of that. I'm the public. That's fine. Let them review that information and make a determination. But it's unfair to say that these kids are out there getting ran over by the dune buggies. There's no statistics to back it up. There's no data. The ambulances aren't running 24 hours a day with children. We had 1.7 million visitors during the time period.
Mr. Patterson has a question. Were you finished?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent Zilke did mention in his testimony that his officers spend an inordinate amount of time dealing with issues where there's no parental or adult supervision. Do you see, it's different than your situation where you're responsible and you manage your children, but obviously the reality is that we are having injuries in the state park, and that state park rangers are having to deal with issues of lack of parental supervision. Do you have any suggestions on how that might be addressed?
Sure. Friends of the Oceano Dunes has been very active in out spreading the word about safety. We have a safety program that we started long before this issue even came up, where we're out trying to educate the public on the requirements for the safety program. Everything from coloring books to literature to information. One of the things I would love to see, and I've seen in other areas, is these people are coming in out of town, maybe to see a billboard on the side of the freeway. Hey, remember, you know, the safety requirements that go along with it. You know, let's keep reminding them of the importance of doing this. There are irresponsible parents in every parts of society. I think it was last year we had a poor child that fell into a fire and got some burns on their leg. Where was the parent supervision? You know, incidents occur all the time out there that the parents aren't supervising their children. State parks, rangers are doing a fantastic job. The 4,000 hours, I don't know how that equates to the patrolling of the snowy plovers, to the issues associated with illegal camping, to the speeding. I can't quantify. Is 4,000 hours a lot or is it not a lot? I mean, we have to spend some time and look at this. We just can't, you know, jump to some conclusion based on very few data points.
Okay, does that conclude your questions, Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The next speaker is Mr. Kevin Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the
well,
board.
You have two here. Are there two Kevin Rices?
No. I think Mr. Sudi filled out a comment card for me earlier
okay.
when I wasn't here.
So it's Kevin Rice followed by Dr. Joe Robinson.
Thank you. I'm not too organized here, but I felt it was important for me to come and speak on this issue. Number one, I want to say that I'm a local resident of this county here. I have the county's interest in mind. I ride and I use the Oceano SVRA frequently, and I enjoy that area greatly. I also share Dr. Foreman's concerns. I'm a full-time professional firefighter in this state, and I do respond and have responded on injured children on OHV equipment, and I share his concerns. However, Dr. Foreman stated right in his own comments that the current laws are being ignored. So how can we say that we need new laws? The laws already say we need adult supervision, and that's not being provided. That seems to me to be the issue, not just shotgun saying we can't let your kids ride an OHV anymore. All the points that Mr. Zilke brought up, that you know, there's problems enforcing and that he sees it all the time, that there's no adult supervision. Again, that's what the current law says. So the issue here is adult supervision. I've seen it on the accidents that I've responded to. The kids are out riding alone. I'm really concerned because when I was little, my friends were into motorcycles, their family, and they invited me along on a trip or two. And I had a lot of good times with them doing those trips and probably kept me out of some trouble. These people that are coming over from Bakersfield and here within this county, they're bringing their kids and they're keeping those kids out of trouble. Those kids are learning to do positive things with their time instead of whatever else they could be doing. This SVRA provides millions of dollars to the local economy in Pismo Beach and AG. by shutting down the opportunity for the children, those families aren't going to recreate here anymore. Those economies are going to lose out big time. Some suggestions I might have might be to limit the commingling of the vehicles. Maybe the SVRA could look into providing an area for children or to exclude the big trucks to where they could recreate with maybe lesser adult supervision directly involved, just to keep the kids in a safer, slower speed area. I don't know. There's some ideas to go there. Also, I wanted to mention that the state auditor recently did a report saying that there's been a lot of misuse of the OHV registration fees. Maybe some of those fees should be being spent on additional enforcement or in some other way to help this issue at the park. I know there's some stats that I haven't seen in Dr. Foreman's writings. One thing I want to say as a firefighter is not every ER visit is a major big deal. I see ER visits all the time for upset stomachs and really silly things just because they want to get looked at by a doctor. So whatever number of children visiting the ER he's got in there, I'd really like to know how many of those are serious injuries and how many are just extraneous.
And thank you for your comments.
Very much.
Thank you. There are no questions. So Dr. Joe Robinson.
Madam Chair, board members, my name is Joe Robinson. I'm an emergency physician. I don't work with Dr. Foreman. I practice at the at two other hospitals, at Sierra Vista Regional Medical Center and Twin Cities Community Hospital. More than 20 emergency physicians also work at these sites. We see patients for ATV accidents as well, though, of course, not in the same degree as Dr. Foreman's site in proximity of the Oceano Dunes. I shared this issue with the other physicians at my site and requested their feedback so that I could speak on behalf of them. And the response has been vigorous. We urge the board to support Dr. Foreman's proposal. It is clear that improvement is necessary. I think everybody agrees that we could do better. Measures taken to date have not produced adequate results. While there remains debate on what the ideal thing to do is to try minimize injuries, we feel that the best chance for improvement would be with Dr. Foreman's proposal. And our interest is in for the protection is for the protection of the children. Once again, we urge support of this proposal. On a personal note, I've noted several arguments to the contrary. And I'm not certain that it would be that difficult to enforce a law when you see somebody riding an ATV that stands at waist high. I would think that that would be fairly clear that that would be a violation of the law. Naturally, there'd be sort of a gray zone where people physically are greater, you know, have a better stature and are going to be difficult to distinguish from people over the law. But you know, in reality, while we'd like to enforce the letter of the law, those people aren't the ones that are probably at the greatest risk. It's the ones that are smaller, which are going to be more obvious. So even incomplete enforcement would probably catch some of the worst, most dangerous positions. As far as Mr. Sudi's information, I commend him for his dedication to good parenting, but if his methods were really practiced by all parents, Dr. Foreman wouldn't have this many injuries to present. And I think that we have to consider the outcome of this and not the process of what's going on. Finally, some attribute the quote to Mark Twain that there are three kinds of lies, damn lies, and statistics. And to kind of put that into perspective, I just did some rapid calculations, and the success rate that Mr. Sudi quotes here is roughly equivalent to serving in the military for one day in Iraq.
Thank you for your comments. Are there any questions? I see none. So with that, I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board for a discussion and or action. And before anybody makes a motion, I have a comment eventually. Mr. Lenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Foreman, if I could just ask one question. In your statistical analysis, but more importantly, in what you've seen firsthand in the emergency room, Can you identify or explain to us what you feel are either the primary collision or causal factors of these injuries? I guess what I'm getting at is I don't think we're seeing a lot of equipment failure, but obviously it appears to be operator error, but can you elaborate on some of these injuries or what you're seeing as far as if somebody falls off or the necks or the traumas, the backs? And in layman's terms, please, not in sure. medical language.
First off is with ATVs and, you know, in general, we had almost 1,200 ATV entries between Arroyo Grande and French in that 20-month period. And they're literally all kinds. The most common ones that we see is usually A, either the child or the adult, for that matter, being thrown from the ATV and usually landing on their, well, any part of their body, for that matter, but frequently collarbones, wrist. You know, first thing you do when you fall, you put your arms out. So that's one of the major reasons for wrist fractures. So you see all those. Then, unfortunately, the real tougher ones is when you get the collisions of ATVs, you know, hitting each other. And those are frequently much more severe as far as causing injuries. Because now you combine, you know, mass versus momentum, and the, you know, the physics involved make for much more force. And so that is a huge problem. Actually, when you mentioned about the statistics and stuff like this, interestingly, I have statistics. I actually have them available. The federal, the United States of America, has made it very clear to me and every single health provider that I cannot divulge it. It's called HIPAA. Now, interestingly, I actually can show, and I actually have them with me. I have a list. It's 18 pages long. It shows every single ATV injury. Now, some of those were actually individuals, pedestrians who were struck by ATVs. Those are really easy. I throw those out. What I did then was look at the 14-year-old and under age. Then I and got those lists, and there was about 212. So then I took the 212 and actually looked at the records. And the way I was able to do that is our emergency medicine committee authorized me going through legal representatives to do a study. And that's the reason, that's how this kind of came apart. I actually got permission, and it was a study to find out about ATV injuries in children. And out of that 212, I was able to eliminate ones I couldn't tell. I'd look at the record, and they'd say dunes, oceanal dunes, out in the sand, you know, those various things. And those were included in mine. If they were on private lands, if they were out in the Los Padres National Forest, I threw them out. And also, obviously, the ones I didn't include was the ones that didn't even come to the emergency room. And so these numbers are actually fairly conservative. And one of the reasons they're so different, absolutely so different from states, is that a lot of these injuries, as you can imagine, if you get hurt, one of the things you don't think about is, you know, telling the ranger, I've been hurt. You want to get medical care. And so they come to me, they go to the emergency room, but some of those probably even wait till they get back to Bakersfield. So I'm sure that even their injury rate is higher. And there is a major discrepancy in the numbers here. I would love to figure out some way, and I don't have an answer, to really find out the true rate of injuries. And I don't know if you can.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions of Dr. Foreman? I see none, so thank you very much. With that, I will...
I have a question for Mr. Zilke, if I may, please, Madam Chair.
Yes.
In the report, Mr. Zilke, you have identified that Off-Highway Motor Vehicles Recreational Division of California State Parks has contracted with the Specialty Vehicle Institute of America to provide free ATV safety training with a certificate for juveniles aged 6 to 17.
Right.
Now, is that statewide, local? Probably statewide.
Yeah,
how
yeah.
do we reach out to make that happen locally, or where is it in the process?
Well, it's through the ATV Safety Institute, and they do have a website, as Dr. Foreman mentioned, for access and determine where the training is available and to apply for that.
Okay. Nothing local here as we speak.
It can be local based on demand. If there's enough interested parties in the Five Cities area or any particular area, training can be provided. And as I mentioned earlier, in addition, we provide training to individuals from our local schools already on an annual basis.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Patterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent Zilke, I know when people enter the state park, I believe as a result of some environmental regulations and the use of the park, the quantity of vehicles, is it feasible to monitor whether or not people have certification to ride the bikes? Would that be something that you could realistically do? I know you commented earlier that an age limit is difficult to enforce. They've got the gear on. You can't really make that judgment as they're riding by. But is there a way that you could monitor that as people are entering the park, just, you know, like a dog license? People are bringing their dog. Do they have a license? That sort of thing?
Well, you know, I don't know what our legal standing would be on something like that, but with regard to providing information relative to the requirements of the certificate program to those that are operating or bring in ATVs, that would be more feasible, I think. We do a lot of literature handouts, safety handouts. In fact, it's in our Oceano Dunes brochure and on our website, et cetera, relative to safety and what the requirements are of operating off-highway motor vehicles in California State Parks. So, it might be more feasible then. I don't know if we have the lawful authority to inquire if someone has a certificate or a license unless we actually have the probable cause to do that. That would be my guess. I'd have to get a legal opinion on that.
But if there were a statute in place that required, you know, people from the age of 6 to 14 have a certificate showing, much like a hunting license. You know, you have to go to hunter safety training course and get certified before you get a license. If there was a program in place to do that, is that something you could feasibly
I think
do?
They would have to legally have to be engaged in the activity before you could ask them that.
I see.
I have no more lights, so.
Okay. Thank you.
But don't go away. You never know. I mean, okay, thank you.
If everybody has spoken, I'll try to make a motion.
No, everybody hasn't.
Sorry?
Everybody hasn't.
I'm sorry.
But I'll make mine brief. You know, as I was reading this over after Dr. Foreman came in to see us and after all of the advertising for November 8th came up, it occurred to me that, you know, one of the propositions on the November 8th ballot is parental responsibility. And just as a side comment, I'll say I voted no on every proposition.
So much for paid political.
Yeah, I believe in, you know, political responsibility. However, I'm wondering when you have a driver that's underage, we have a mechanism for determining that driver is underage, does not have a license, and should not be driving that vehicle. He's driving in an unsafe manner. When a kid goes into a bar, regardless of how they look, the bar owner has a responsibility to make sure that that kid doesn't drink if the child is underage. You know, we have all of these criteria for kids. So this is not a precedent-setting issue. And to use the excuse that all of that money will go somewhere else, I tell you, I have 5 kids, and I find that a very, very distressing statement. Because in my mind, how much is an injured child worth? We need to take care of the kids first and think about other things, you know, a little bit later. So I would support an ordinance that's enforceable, for one thing. We do have to have enforceable ordinances, but also one where the parents are responsible for that kid and that the penalty is not a $2 fine, that the penalty is severe enough that it will force parental responsibility. So anyway, with that...
Mr. Ovid has his
son. Mr. Ovid.
I got it in there.
Thank you.
I want to say that the first thing is that I agree with
the issue on number two and number five. It has to be that it comes under the parents' issue. I don't see that if you put a prohibition on it, you're going to stop anything, predominantly because you still have private property, you still have other areas you have it. One of the comments I wrote down on here when he says any public land, to me that means Mid-State Fair couldn't hold its organized races, and they have races for kids in this age group, which are sanctioned. They would not be allowed to do that if we had a complete prohibition, and again, that's a family issue. When we looked at curfew laws here in the county many years back, the whole thing pointed back at the parents' responsibility. And I think, you know, if you don't do that, no matter what you do in terms of prohibition or anything, you're not going to achieve it. And as far as injuries to kids, I don't know how you're going to stop it. And I'm being facetious, but we should outlaw trees and fence and playground equipment and everything else because, you know, we've heard all our lives that these kids get injured on this, and yes, it is an issue. I'm not living in effect. But for whatever reason in growing up, it's part of this growing up. And I don't know, you know, it's sad when you know, you have a pool in the backyard and you lose your child to that pool. But are you supervising that kid? That is the end result of this whole issue. And I really don't see us getting involved in this unless we can put it really on behalf of the parents. But as far as prohibition, I'm not in that particular mode. I think it's more that we have to put more responsibility on the parents so that if the law enforcement agencies stop a child out there and he's not by supervision, there has to be some kind of responsibility that parent has to absorb, whether it's through a ticket or fine or however it's done.
With a maximum fine.
Well, yeah, it's you can go to court on that. I mean, but I think it has to push that.
Let me see if I can find a balancing act between Supervisor Ovid and Supervisor Bianchi. And with all understanding that this is the law, we're not here to make the law change. We're here to listen to the concerns. It is a concern, and I wholeheartedly believe that it needs to come to our attention. But where does the buck stop? Obviously, it's not here. And Mr. Morici has done an excellent job by putting this staff report together. It's not something we deal with it every day. It's not a land use element, but it goes way beyond that. So in appreciation for his hard work, what I would like to propose we do that, we take this staff reporting and add to it, Mr. Morici, so you were taking some notes from some of the good comments were made here, package it, and send it to our assemblyman and senator for them to review and see where we go from there. And board members might want to add a word to that or take out a word. I'm just trying to think quickly, not necessarily quickly, but trying to think thoughtfully as how can we bring this concern and help Dr. Foreman and Mr. Zilke with their concern as where it needs to go, where pretty much the buck stops. And for us, in appreciation of all the input we received here, I think we need to be the conduit to send it forward, to move it forward.
I second that motion with a comment also that I think...
Wait a minute. My problem is, what are we doing?
Yeah, what was the specific motion?
Yeah.
The specific motion was, and this is where I said I'm going to need some wording here, so without getting too excited, I already opened that window for you to jump in. Take tech staff's reporting and add to it all the comments we heard here today, and that's a form of a package deal to send to our elected officials on a state level to bring it to their attention. And if the boards also find that number five needs to be something that we can support so that they know where our support is coming from, to read, to also be aware of our staff's reporting, and at number five, if that's the consensus here. So it's a form of a motion, but I'm willing to go back and forth and change the wording to see where everybody's satisfied with it, because it is a difficult one to make here, knowing that we're not going to make this law.
Mr. Edge.
Trying to interpret Supervisor Ashajian.
Thank you.
And frame it in the form of a motion and tell me if I get this right. I think that what you would want then is a motion that says direct staff to forward this information, including Vince's staff report and the comments here today, forward them to Mr. Blakesley and Mr. Maldonado, indicating that the board heard various viewpoints. This is clearly a significant issue that that deserves a comprehensive state review of both sides of the discussion, and that you urge them to ask their respective state authorities to undertake such a review.
With particular emphasis on item number five. I would like to add that. Item five is parental responsibility.
I have a point on that, and I kind of disagree with Mr. Edge's nebulous thing. You know,
you don't like his
friends. You know, it's kind of like throwing it up there. I think even a good doctor has run into the same issue where go back and get your facts. You know, to go ask the legislature to kind of look at something, you know, they got enough to do. They may not even go with it if there's not enough interest. The other issue is, according to the staff's report, there is a temporary action. There's an action before the courts. And as I read it, it's talking about the superintendent's order.
Right.
Which puts the parents' responsibility. So why do I want to do anything? And maybe that comes out. And that's why I said when I looked at that page, it says, well, here's your options to consider. If we're going to send anything forward, it'd be the staff report. But I think really I wouldn't see us doing anything until we understand if we are going to make the parents more responsible. And then in number five, if there is any legislation that comes out of this, that in the licensure and the certification, or if your kid's caught writing in an unsafe situation, however it's written, that then the parents or the guardians are the ones responsible. And I think that's where we have to put the onus back on. And I want to be direct. And that's as direct as I can. Instead of maybe you should do something. I don't know.
Well, that's
I don't
why
think
I...
Maybe you should do something with...
Mr.
Have somebody else translate.
Mr. Lenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to Supervisor Zobrist's comment, I don't think these are mutually exclusive events where you have to do one without the other. I think you can also have item number two for action and support the legislative change, because this will be a work in progress. We don't know what that work in progress is going to be. We don't know the final outcome. I believe that Dr. Foreman is going to have some additional statistical information that, as this goes forward, if we send a letter to Senator Maldonado and Assemblyman Blakesley saying that we request that you carefully review this based on the information we have and also look at some of the outstanding staff work that Vince Marucci's done, that we're not locking anything in. We're just giving someone direction or guidance, and that's why I seconded Supervisor Asaji's motions to do that. As far as the exact language, I don't think we need to spend a lot of time now wordsmithing what this letter is going to say, but we are going to say, or hopefully come to agreement, that we think this is important, that requires additional staff work and additional investigation by other state agencies. That's what I understand or understood Supervisor Asajan's motion to be.
And I still want to add that language with particular emphasis on on parental responsibility, however you want to phrase that.
And that's what I'm saying is if you structure it, as Mr. Edge is saying in that, it doesn't specifically point to one action.
Five
or six that are on that page you're talking about, number two is a potential action that's happening, and if you go with number five,
no,
it says we support legislation that makes the parents responsible.
I would disagree with Mr. Ovitt, and I keep waiting for these lights, and then I never get a chance to say anything. By supporting the legislative change that would hold parents, guardians, or authorized adults responsible, in my mind, that would support the superintendent's order. Even though it's under court review, we want to support that order to place responsibility on the parent, guardian, or authorized adult. So it's not mutually exclusive,
the same thing you are. Just saying that those two are more directed specifically.
Right, at a specific action.
Guardian response. Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Marucci.
Yeah. Madam Chair, when the options for consideration were put together, subsequent to putting these together, I spoke with Superintendent Zilke, and he indicated that the state parks, and I believe he made brief mention of it here today, we're going to support a legislative change rather than to continue pursuing the superintendent's order, because there could be some potential problems with in enforcing a superintendent's order on a long-term basis. At least that was my perspective.
Okay, Mr. Zilke, for the record, is nodding up and down.
And so while the board's perspective may be to support and strongly support, or at least some board members may want to support parental supervision, it would probably be more appropriate to support number 5 than number 2.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Lenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just wanted to summarize that I see this as we are giving support, we're lending our support to give law enforcement, to give Superintendent Zilke, the Highway Patrol, the Sheriff's Department, whomever else are out there, the tools that they need to do the job. Now, what those tools are, we can't define here. But we all know the desired result that we want. We want to ensure that you have parental accountability. You do that in a variety of ways. We need to ensure that we have more education opportunities. We've talked about that. There is a resource that's available to do that. Perhaps we need to improve some of the marketing or advertising to make sure people know that. But I don't see us creating these tools. I see us going forward to say that we recognize there's a need here and there's some specific tools and criteria that need to be met. Now let's give the authority to those people that are out there enforcing that the option to do that. That's all we're doing today.
And that's what number 5 does.
Exactly.
So I'm wondering if Mr. Shajan would like to change his motion to read that we support a legislative change that would hold parents, guardians, or authorized adults responsible. And that makes it very specific.
I think I already did that, Madam Chair, but I can be wrong.
Well, I think what you did originally was you directed staff to take the public comments, the staff report, and forward them on to our local legislators with the understanding that we had a strong emphasis from the board of number 5, which was the parental.
Right. And okay. Does that satisfy?
But just
because well,
yeah.
Number 5.
Yeah, it, that would.
The motion, yeah.
Okay. You know, I was just trying to save staff time by just saying that after all of this hearing and everything, the motion would be that we support a legislative change so that Mr. Marici wouldn't have to go through all of the comments and compile them, et cetera, et cetera. After Mr. Kovacs' comments this morning, I'm a little sensitive.
There's such a great effort, and my idea was as we go to officials elected on state level to see where we're coming from and a lot of study here that will support what we're doing rather than, but that was the idea behind it and not to add more onto Mr. Morici's desk, which I think he looks forward to it.
Okay, Mr. Patterson, briefly, and then we have to have a motion.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
A vote on the motion.
I just want to publicly thank Dr. Foreman for bringing this issue to the public's attention, and I appreciate all the effort that has gone into it. Unfortunately, children don't have the ability to select who their parents are, and I'm certainly in agreement with the other board members that we ought to focus on parental responsibility. I would like staff to summarize public comment and board comments and send that off so there is some context to what our decision is, and I'm not going to add this to the motion because I don't want to complicate things, but I do think it's appropriate to look into some sort of certification program very similar to the hunter safety program that is well established. I did that when I was 12 years old, and that was a long time ago, so it's been around, it's been effective, and I don't see why we couldn't do something like that for the use of ATVs.
Okay. We have a motion. Have we had a second?
You do have a second, but
we'll let Mr. Shajan's motion stand.
All right.
With emphasis on item number 5.
On number 5, right.
This is a voice vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Yes. Opposed? Hearing none. We will now move on to closed session. Is there anyone in the public who wishes to address the board on a closed session, our closed session items? Seeing none, we will go into closed session and return at 2:00.